And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, this week has been a battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. I don't know whether it's a heart or an absence of a heart, maybe the dark, empty soul. But whatever it is, a true leader has emerged, someone who represents the best of Republican values. I'm talking, of course, about the fat, Oxycontin-addicted Rush Limbaugh, who made clear today that all Republicans must bow to him. Even the chairman of the Republican Party, Michael Steele, no sooner than 24 hours, less than 24 hours, after saying that some of Rush's comments are incendiary and ugly, that he's only an entertainer, came back, hat in hand, on his knees, begging forgiveness to Darth Rush, his overlord, telling him to please, please forgive him. That after Rush Limbaugh spent 20 minutes talking about how Michael Steele got off.
I just wanted to let everyone know that Bob would be a replay tonight. He's taken Ferg to the Honors Band, which he's involved in, and doing the family thing. But he will be back live with you tomorrow night at 6 p.m. And I know that he's disappointed that he had to be away, but he's dealing with the boy. So everyone have a good night, and we love you.
To a shaky start. Yes, Steele may be the technical head of the Republican Party, but we all know that Rush Limbaugh is its true head. Every single Republican now that has criticized Rush Limbaugh has gone back on hands and knees begging forgiveness. Of course, the first to do this was Congressman Phil Gingrey of Georgia. He, on January 27th, said, quote, "It's easy if you're Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh or even sometimes Newt Gingrich to stand back and throw bricks. You don't have to try to do what's best for your people and your party. You're just on these talk shows and you're living well. You like to stir up controversy, but that doesn't mean they would be good leaders." Now, this is non-controversial, just like Michael Steele telling Rush Limbaugh that some things he says are ugly and incendiary. That's non-controversial. In fact, Rush Limbaugh himself and I have had the sad dishonor of hearing the fat addict speak at a radio convention where everyone except me gave him a standing ovation and everyone except me bent down to kiss his ass. But I have heard him say that he's only an entertainer and that it's all, it's all done with a wink and a nod. It's all done to make people mad. Even Rush doesn't believe in what Rush claims to believe, at least so he says, behind closed doors. Well, Republicans know that, politicians know it, but as soon as they tell the truth, well, they're forced, within 24 hours forced, to make an apology. Congressman Gingrey was practically on his hands and knees begging forgiveness. Quote, "I regret and apologize for the fact that my comments have offended and upset my fellow conservatives. That was not my intent. Rush Limbaugh is a conservative giant, the voice of the conservative movement's conscience. Every day, millions and millions of Americans, myself included, turn on their radios and televisions to listen to what they have to say. We are inspired by their words, by his determination." And they say that they're Democrats. They consider Obama the Messiah. The irony is that I don't hear that much from Democrats. Frankly, we on the left are known as a contentious bunch, as was famously said by Will Rogers, who said, I am not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat. We constantly harp on our own, criticize our own, and that's okay. That's what thinking human beings do. We criticize our own, we come to conclusions, and we recognize that Obama, for all his failures, is far, far superior to George W. Bush, or frankly, any president in my lifetime, at least thus far. But Republicans are not good at criticizing each other because they recognize that Rush Limbaugh is their leader. They may not like him as their leader. They may grumble behind their back, but he is their leader. And there's one thing I want to make clear in tonight's show is how much he is their leader, how much he has rebuilt the Republican Party in his image, and why that has brought the Republican Party to ashes, where I hope they remain for a long time. Now, you know what? I take that back. Rush Limbaugh said, I hope Obama fails. I hope the Republican Party succeeds. I hope the Republican Party rejects Rush Limbaugh. If they reject Rush Limbaugh, if they reject the idea that, the rich should become richer and the poor should serve the rich, if they actually come toward the center, I would welcome that Republican Party. I would love to have a Republican Party willing to work with the president to see where they could agree and where they could disagree. That's Obama's view. That's my view as well. But I do hope the Republican Party of Rush Limbaugh fails. Cousin Gingrey not only apologized on the 28th, but later that day apologized again directly to Darth Rush. I don't know whether Darth Rush was using the dark side of the Force to put the stranglehold on him, but it sure sounded like it, didn't it? Ask yourself if this doesn't sound like somebody who's in the stranglehold of Darth Vader. Congressman Gingrey said, and this is a direct quote, Rush, thank you so much. I thank you for the opportunity. Of course, it's not exactly the way I wanted to come on, but I appreciate your giving me the opportunity. Mainly, I want to express to you and all your listeners my very sincere regret for those comments I made. I clearly ended up putting my foot in my mouth on some of those comments, and I just wanted to tell you, Rush, that I regret those stupid comments. What were the stupid comments? Merely that Rush Limbaugh likes to stir up a bit of controversy and gin up the base? And it doesn't mean he'd necessarily be a good leader? That's what he's so base and abjectly apologetic for when Rush Limbaugh himself admits he's just trying to stir up people? When Rush Limbaugh says he's not the leader of the Republican Party? Whatever Rush thinks, he is their leader. And I think that Democrats, and I got to say, I got to give President Obama credit for pushing Republicans and saying, are you with him or against him? Remember all the talk about Obama and Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And it was pushed, and you know what? I think it was fair. Yeah, it went over the top at times. But I think it was fair to ask Obama what are his views on his pastor, and he gave a very complex answer, as liberals are wont to do. And then his pastor went further, and Obama was forced to distance himself. Again, I think the right thing to do. Well, I think we have to ask Republicans the exact same thing about Rush Limbaugh. Are you for him or are you against him? Rush Limbaugh, just last weekend, you probably know, gave an 85-minute speech before the Conservative Political Action Conference. We talk radio hosts are known to be long-winded. It's true. And Limbaugh, certainly the longest-winded. But the audience is more interesting than the buffoon on stage, because they did treat him like the Messiah. They treated him better, certainly, than the Germans treated Obama. It was all breathless, rush, 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 star-struck applause, wrote Kathleen Parker, the conservative columnist. Star-struck applause by a grateful audience. And Rush told the audience, says Kathleen Parker, that Obama, in essence, is Stalin. And, of course, everybody cheered. This is a direct quote by Rush Limbaugh in his 20-minute on-air attack on Michael Steele for saying the obvious point that Rush is often ugly. In fact, I think he used the word sometimes, that he's sometimes ugly or incendiary. Here is Limbaugh. Why do you claim you lead the Republican Party when you seem obsessed with seeing to it that President Obama succeeds? I, frankly, am stunned that the chairman of the Republican National Committee endorses such an agenda. I have to conclude that he does because he attacks me for wanting it to fail. For wanting it to fail. For wanting Obama to fail. And one of the fascinating things now is already Republicans are rewriting this history. We'll have Mike Lane on the show, and you'll hear the spin bite. I'm predicting this in advance. I haven't talked to Mike about it. You will hear him say, Rush wasn't saying he wanted the country to fail. He wasn't saying he wanted Obama to fail. He was saying that, he wants his policies to fail, that he wants the country to succeed. Well, who's in charge of the country? You know, it's one thing to say, as I might have said on George Bush, I hope he succeeds, but I think he'll fail. That's a very different thing. It's a very, very different thing from saying, I hope he fails. What Rush is saying, it's very interesting how conservatives and liberals approach issues. I want you to think about this. Liberals say, what is best for the country? What is best for economic progress, for all Americans, not just the rich, but including the rich, but also the middle class, the poor? What is the best for our environment so we can breathe clean air and drink clean water for the future? What is the best for our children? What is the best for us in the world? How can we help prevent future wars? What's the best for the country? Healthcare system. Then they look at the problems, as Obama has. President Obama has, he brings in people from all different views, puts them together, has them work on the problems, and come to find solutions. It takes more time. That's why Republicans are better at spin bites than we are. They can give their answer in a minute. We tend to want to get the correct answer, which means that if we're going to describe science, for example, it requires a lot of nuance. Try to describe the theory of evolution in 20 seconds. It's not easy to do. Say God created it, and you've done it all in three words. And that is how Republicans approach problems. They approach problems by assuming they're right and then finding the facts to support what they've already believed to be right. The Downing Street memo, of course, put it all very clearly and very bluntly. President Bush, Republicans, conservatives, fix the facts around the policy. You make the policy first, you find the facts second. Now, I happen to have talked once to the person who wrote the memo for Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, when he invaded Grenada. President Reagan invaded the small island of Grenada, and while invading, while our troops were on the island fighting there, gave his lawyers 48 hours to justify it, at which point they did their best to do so and came up with an obscure treaty that they said justified it. But that's exactly how Republicans work. Take action first, justify it later. As Richard Nixon once said, if the president does it, it's not against the law. Do it, find justification later. Indeed, my former law school classmate, John Yoo, the person who wrote all those torture and awful memos, was the classic lawyer who, the toady lawyer who justified what the president already decided he wanted done. In essence, really, I got to, and this may be the only time I've ever defended John Yoo, but in some sense I do have to defend him in the sense that I don't think he designed the policies. I think Cheney said, I want to torture, and he said to John Yoo, give me a memo to justify what I want to do. And frankly, if John Yoo hadn't given him that memo, he would have been fired. And then some toady lawyer would have. Now, that no more justifies John Yoo any more than it justifies a lower down Nazi who pulls the switch that lets the gas into the chamber. But we should be clear that the person who's just following orders, while evil, is of a lesser evil than the person who gives the orders. I think that's fair. John Yoo, while evil, is less evil than the Cheney and the Rove and the others who told him what to do. And so Republicans are very much act first, justify later. And that's the basic distinction between them. And Rush Limbaugh is in many ways the id of the Republican Party, right? He says, I hope Obama fails. That's his first goal. His first goal is to destroy President Obama. His first goal is to destroy the Democratic Party. And if it means bringing the country down with him, so be it. Rush Limbaugh has his priorities in order. Raise the power of Rush Limbaugh, number one. Raise the Republican Party, number two. Destroy the Democrats, number three. And the country be damned. Rush hopes that President Obama fails because he knows if President Obama succeeds, then he, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, will lead a liberal America, and his ideas will lead a liberal America for decades to come. And Rush doesn't want that. Very, very different. Now, you're going to hear people arguing differently. Rush has himself portrayed this all kinds of different ways, saying that, no, I just hope his policies fail, which really is the same thing. Rush wants our country to be in a Great Depression, because they can go, ha-ha. And like I said, he's the id of the Republican Party. He says what Republicans say in private, only he says so publicly. So I want to play for you the actual quote, and I'm sorry to do this to you, because I don't want any of you to have vomiting fits or retch attacks, and if you need to step away from the computer, I understand. But I want to play for you the full 4-minute clip. I may have to interrupt in the middle because, I don't know how long I can stand it. But of what Rush Limbaugh actually said, because I think context is important, and all the Republicans that say we were taking him out of context, listen to the full context of what he had to say.
I got a request here from a major American print publication. Dear Rush, for the Obama Immaculate Inauguration, we are asking a handful of very prominent politicians, statesmen, scholars, businessmen, commentators, and economists to write 400 words on their hope for the Obama presidency. We would love to include you. If you could send us 400 words on your hope for the Obama presidency, we need it by Monday night, that would be ideal.
Did you notice he used the word immaculate? If anyone doubts the mainstream media is conservative, ask why they are attacking Obama already to Rush, on President Obama's immaculate inauguration. Okay, so they want to say, what is your hope? They want to get different views. The conservative mainstream media is getting presumably some liberals, and they're asking Rush Limbaugh, what is his hope? Here's how he responds.
We're caught in this trap again. The premise is, what is your hope for the... My hope, and please understand me when I say this, I disagree fervently with the people on our side of the aisle who have caved and who say, well, I hope he succeeds. We've got to give him a chance. Why?
Got that? I disagree fervently with those that say, I hope he succeeds, we've got to give him a chance. I know even Democrats, liberals, like me, who were astounded by the coup d'etat of the United States Supreme Court. I mean, here we had the United States Supreme Court illegally, unlawfully perform a coup d'etat and enforce upon us a president who lost an election. And yet I didn't hear people saying, I hope he fails. Indeed, with a president like Ronald Reagan or George Bush Sr., neither of whom I voted for, I did hope they would succeed. I don't think they did. But I hoped they would. Rush Limbaugh is different. Rush Limbaugh wants President Obama to fail, even if it means great danger to the entire American people, even if it means great damage to our economy. He angrily disagrees with the people who want to give the president the benefit of the doubt, to give him a shot. And in doing so, he really represents the 20-some-odd percent of people that never stopped liking George Bush, or the 18% that like Dick Cheney. I know I've got a caller on the line. I'll get with you in just a second, Kevin. I do want to finish, though, playing this clip. I'll try not to interrupt too much. It is hard not to. Let's hear more.
They didn't give Bush a chance in 2000 before he was inaugurated. The search and destroy mission had begun. I'm not talking about search and destroy, but I've been listening to Barack Obama for a year and a half. I know what his politics are. I know what his plans are as he has stated them. I don't want them to succeed. If I wanted Obama to succeed, I'd be happy the Republicans have laid down. And I would be encouraging Republicans to lay down and support him. I don't want, look, what he's talking about is the absorption of as much of the private sector by the U.S. government as possible. From the banking business, to the mortgage industry, to the automobile business, to the healthcare. I do not want the government in charge of all of these things. I don't want this to work.
Because what happens if it works? What happens if it works? What happens if Americans are happy with their health care? I mean, we saw what happened with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because remember, that's really the heart. That's really the enemy, the true enemy of Republicans. What happened with FDR? We brought Social Security. And now 80, 90% of Americans support Social Security? We have Medicare. And yeah, our health care is too expensive, and yeah, we can do better, and yeah, you know, if we were to get rid of the middleman, like in Canada, we could save more money. But most Americans like Medicare. They like Social Security. Rush Limbaugh is scared to death that if Medicare for all works, then Americans might just like it. Don't let them taste freedom. They might like it. Don't let them taste the good life. They might like it. Right? You don't want someone you're keeping down in chains to taste good food, and you don't want your dog to taste good food, right? If you feed your dog dog food, your dog's happy with dog food, but once your dog tastes steak, he or she's going to beg at the table all night. Don't let poor people have a chance. Don't let Americans have health care. They'll just clamor for it more. Rush Limbaugh is scared. He is scared that President Obama's policies will succeed. And that's why he doesn't want to even give him a chance to succeed. It's not like, you know, a liberal would say, well, you know, I don't believe in conservative policies, but if he tries them and they fail, we'll be able to use that as an example for the future. We'll try to stop them. And if they fail, well, that'll just be proof. Not Rush Limbaugh. He's saying, I don't want them to have a chance. And Republicans laying down, well, not a single Republican in the House of Representatives voted for President Obama's stimulus package. So were they caving, or were they listening to Rush Limbaugh? Clearly, once the leader had spoken, they had no choice. On with the clip.
So I'm thinking of replying to the guys, okay, I'll send you a response, but I don't need 400 words. I need four. I hope he fails. Well, what are you laughing at? See, here's the point. Everybody thinks it's outrageous to say. I mean, look at even my staff. Oh, you can't do that. Why not? Why is it any different? What's new? What is unfair about my saying I hope liberalism fails? Liberalism is our problem. Liberalism is what's gotten us dangerously close to the precipice here. Why do I want more of it? I don't care what the drive-by story is. I would be honored if the drive-by media headlined me all day long, Limbaugh : I hope Obama fails.
I would be honored if the media said all along, Limbaugh : I hope Obama fails. So next time you hear some Republican apologist, including one I may invite on my show, say, well, no, Limbaugh was just saying that, you know, I hope that, you know, certain policies. No, he said, I hope Obama fails. Don't let them talk you out of it. You just heard the full clip. They'll say it was taken out of context. I just played for you the full context. You got it. Now let me go to the phones. Kevin from New York City has been holding on a long time. Kevin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
What was a bit of history lesson here? What was Hitler's occupation before he became Chancellor of Germany?
He was a failed artist.
Nope.
Well, he was a failed artist. He may have.
He was a failed artist, but in between.
I know he's in jail, and he tried a putsch, which is like a coup. He was in the military. I know that. You may have another one that I don't know. Tell me, Kevin.
Radio talk show host.
Really?
Yep.
I did not know that. I did
radio
not know
talk
that.
Show host.
You know, it's interesting because in the United States at that time, in the 1930s, the most rabid anti-Semitism was pushed forward by a radio talk show host called Father Coughlin, who had really ripped up people into mass hate. A lot of people don't realize that during World War II, it wasn't until after the death counts were disclosed, during World War II, all 4 of the 5 years of World War II, Americans thought Jews were a bigger threat to the United States than either Germany or Japan. And that's largely because of people like Father Coughlin and people like you know, Pat Buchanan's father or Lindbergh and so forth. No, the radio is a very powerful way to push hate. Very powerful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
In fact, one of the reasons I'm in radio was to counteract the likes of the Oxycontin-riddled fat man.
Well, why do you think I call every day to support?
And I'm glad you do support us, and I hope you support that on Radio Network.
People need to be aware. And to me, it's uncanny that he was wearing black too, and his hair was slicked back. He looked like a fat European.
He's Darth Vader. He just needs the mask.
He looks like Hitler's second-in-command who's in charge of the Luftwaffe.
Oh, I was thinking just
fly a plane,
the propaganda manager.
Luftwaffe.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of them gurrying him. I'm sure the propaganda minister was Joseph Goebbels. The interesting thing, I mean, Rush Limbaugh is actually a fascinating case study. I mean, he reminds me a lot of Joe McCarthy. In fact, I know a lot more about Joe McCarthy than I do about, I guess, Rush Limbaugh or Adolf Hitler, because I did an extensive year-long project in my high school on him. So I know a lot about Joe McCarthy. But Joe McCarthy, most people don't realize, when he was deciding to run for re-election, he was a junior senator from Wisconsin. The idea of communism in government was not even in his mind. He was going to do it on widening the St. Lawrence Seaway to allow more ships, you know, which is good for Wisconsin, which borders the Great Lakes. And that's what he was going to run for re-election on. And one of his staff said, almost as a joke, why don't you do it on communism in government? And everybody had a good laugh, and they were a little drunk at the time. And McCarthy started doing a riff on it. Yeah, like all these communists in government. And then, of course, he actually on a small plane in West Virginia came out with literally a laundry list. We now know it was a laundry list. It said, you know, 2 pants, 1 shirt. It was a laundry list. And he said, I have a list here of the communists in the U.S. government. And it took off from there. Here's a man who didn't believe his own lies at the beginning. But after being treated as a hero, year after year after year, after he was praised, after he became the leader of the right-wing movement, based on his claim of communist in government, which he never proved, never found a single one. And, you know, then came the House Committee on American Activities and the blacklist of Hollywood, and he became such a leader that by 3, 4, 5 years into it, he believed every word. What began as a joke became his life's work. And I think, frankly, Rush Limbaugh is exactly the same way. I think he began as a joke. You know, he was a DJ. This is a guy who's never went to college.
Well, he was a welfare recipient.
Well, exactly. He's a welfare recipient. He never went to college, never had an education. He was a DJ. This is before talk radio existed. He was a DJ. He changed the records and said, next up, you know, is Elvis Presley, blah, blah. That's what he was. And, you know, once he just started talking a bit more and more and more, and you know, he did well as an entertainer. But now he is truly the head of the Republican Party. When Michael Steele has to bow down and scrape before him, and the things that Michael Steele said, I'm going to play some of them for you. But, you know, basically, I don't know. I have no idea what I was saying, and how could I have said such a thing? And, of course, you're wonderful. And this is the head of the Republican Party. There can be no doubt that their real leader is Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, yeah. You know, nobody, and the thing is, again, well, you see, Michael Steele is such a soulless, like most black Republicans are, you know, because any time you side along an entity that's 99% against the interests of 99% of your people who look like you, or who could be related to you, then something is wrong with you to begin with.
So you know, I happen to know a decent number of black Republicans because I live in the only area of the country where they exist, which is Washington, D.C. I think.
Oh, yeah, and it's all a hustle. It's the biggest hustle going on.
Exactly, and they're paid a high amount of money. I mean, we know what happened with Armstrong Williams, where he was paid $250,000 just to endorse No Child Left Behind.
Yeah.
If you are a black Republican, I mean, you know, you all five of them in the country were at the Republican National Convention because they wanted to show their faces on camera.
If you're a black Republican and you're broke, you must be a total idiot.
Well, you wouldn't be broke because you'd find your way in and they would pay you a lot of money because you could be their token. Michael Steele was hilarious. He was talking on, I forget what show, about how Republicans need to use hip-hop to, you know, push their message. As if it were the media and not the message. As if Republicans could use hip-hop and convince, you know, alienated, unemployed black youth that really they need capital gains tax cuts. You know, if they just did it in hip-hop, they'd get it, right? Change the word bitches and hoes to capital gains tax cuts tax cuts for the rich.
He is capitalizing off of the ignorance of a lot of bigoted, wealthy, you know, white people who don't know and don't really want to know, so he'll feed them anything.
Well, you know, they're trying everything, right? I mean, I think that's part of the reason, frankly, why they're pushing Bobby Jindal. Who actually is educated? I got to give him that. Unlike, you know,
he's educated, but he's desperate.
Well, he is, and I mean, but even Bobby Jindal has the same exact mantra as a Rush Limbaugh. It is, the government will always fail you, therefore don't trust the government. In other words, when conservatives are in charge, they screwed up in Katrina, therefore you can never trust the government, therefore you want to put we new conservatives in charge, those of us who want to dismantle the government, even though whenever we come to power, then we want big government. It's a weird kind of... I mean, it requires Americans to forget, first of all, that there have been hurricanes before Katrina where Bill Clinton and FEMA Director James Lee Witt did a tremendous job, Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Hugo. There's a long list where a lot, you know, so it requires people to forget that. It requires people to make this very strange leap of faith. It was as if Bobby Jindal had hoped that the government would fail in Katrina. It was as if Republicans all across the nation wanted the government to fail in Katrina, because even if 1,000 people died, and people need to remember that number because not enough people talk about it, 1,000 Americans died. They talk about the 3,000 Americans dead on September 11th, and that was caused by a foreign terrorist group. Well, 1,000 Americans are dead due to our own government incompetence, and that's got nothing to do with terrorism. 1,000 Americans died. Billions of dollars lost in property and homes and treasures that people had for all these years. And I honestly think most Republicans, like Rush Limbaugh, wanted the government to fail so they could make Governor Jindal's argument. And I should call him Piyush Jindal because I understand. He goes by Bobby just to – I got to remember to do that. But Piyush Jindal wants the government to fail. Because then he can make the argument, Grover Norquist's argument, that you want to make the government so small that you can drown it in a bathtub.
Yeah.
And it's this weird argument they're making. They want President Obama to fail because if he succeeds, it will show America that government can do good, and God knows we can't do that. That will cause Americans to be hooked on things like Social Security and Medicare and all these other very successful programs.
They need a permanent underclass.
Exactly right.
That's the only way despotism works.
Well, look, I mean, was it Jesus who said the poor will always be with us? I don't doubt there will always be some that are poor.
But
it seems the Republicans want more.
Trail.
They want more, exactly. They want more that are poor. They want to redistribute wealth, as has happened in the last 8 years, from the poor to the wealthy.
Oh, and now 530 since Reagan.
What's that?
It's not just 8 years, it's 30 years since Reagan.
Well, but it's really, you can subdivide, you're right, Kevin, but you can subdivide it. If you look at the Clinton years, for example, you will see that, yes, the rich got richer, but the middle class got richer, and the poor got richher under Bill Clinton. If you look at the median, even the 20% level, it went up under Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I have to disagree with you because Clinton just went along and he did what he could. Okay, but if you look at the core, and I'm talking true heart, no real wealth has been created in this country in 30 years. And I'm going back to my Adam Smith logic of wealth. Okay, the dot-com boom is what generated a lot of prosperity, but there was no real wealth, tangible wealth created under the dot-com boom. And take it from somebody who works with computers. Because most of the...
I don't know about that. I mean, we have American computers and technology sold all around the world.
But it's being worked by people who are not American, for the most part, a lot of it.
Well, right. But, you know, I mean, look, Microsoft, and I'm the first to criticize Microsoft and Apple. Yeah. I mean, these are American companies.
They're American companies. They're rank and file. The people who... Put it this way, if you have to call Microsoft or Apple, what is the likelihood of you having an American on the other side of that phone?
Very unlikely, but that's outsourcing. That's
yeah, exactly, and that's...
It's different. I just think that if you look at the economy, and I agree with you, it's been a problem for 30 years, but you will see that in the Clinton administration, you will find that not just the rich, but the middle class, the lower middle class, and even the poor...
Everybody prospered, yes.
That's right.
Great.
But that wasn't true under Reagan or Bush Sr., and the worst case, of course, was Bush Jr.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100%. But I think it just came to a head under Bush Jr.
Well, I think it all fell apart. At that point, we were you know, cutting taxes for the rich, spending massive amounts of money on wars and losing billions of dollars, and the waste was incredible. And then we were cutting regulation at the same time so that bankers and Wall Street execs could just line their pockets with gold and run away. And at the same time, we were rewarding companies that took their businesses off seas. I mean, at some point, you can only do that for so long, and even a country and an economy as great as ours is going to fall apart. But what's fascinating to me is that the Republican leader, Rush Limbaugh, I have as early as November 6th, the election was November 4th, 2 days after the election, Limbaugh was already calling this the Obama recession. So they make the mistakes, and then they're determined to blame it on the new president.
Yeah. Well, you see, again, you have to ignore Rush Limbaugh, okay? And when I mean ignore, I mean not totally ignore him.
I don't want to ignore
him. Huh?
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I don't want to ignore him. To me, I think the more we show, and I think people are starting to see this, the Democratic Party, President Obama is not ignoring him, and neither is his press spokesman, because I think once people see that this clown, and he is a clown, that this, ignorant clown is running the Republican Party, they can see that that's the alternative. And I think it actually leads to more strength to President Obama. I want to ask every Republican.
Well, yeah, I'll give you that.
Whose side do you want?
I don't want to completely ignore him.
I think Media Matters, for example, does a tremendous job in exposing him for what he is.
Yeah, but who really concerns me more is the Joe Scarboroughs.
Well, that's because Joe Scarborough can sound reasonable, and Rush never can.
Yeah, and he sounds intellectual. But he's not that far over from Rush.
No, right? They aren't. The only difference is Rush takes the patina off. He takes the coating off. He's the id of the Republican Party. And that's why they can't reject him. That's why the congressmen, Gingrey and Michael Steele, have to go and bow to him and apologize and kiss his ring. They have to because they know that really they're the same. That if they denounce Rush Limbaugh, they'd be denouncing themselves. They just want to cover him up. They want to make everything seem so nice. But he is saying what they really believe.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Kevin. I want to play some more clips if I can. But I appreciate your call, Kevin. And if others want to call in, the number, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I want to play this clip because it's bigger than Limbaugh, obviously. This is a clip on MSNBC where you have the host repeating exactly what Michael Steele said. And she's repeating it to Pat Buchanan. Now, Pat Buchanan is a great example of a Rush Limbaugh who has coated over the edges. I mean, Pat Buchanan's a nasty person. When I was a Nazi hunter, Pat Buchanan defended every single Nazi war criminal that I worked hard to deport. Pat Buchanan is the closest thing, well, he, I, we have to fascism in America in terms of what he supports. He comes from that tradition, that Father Coughlin, that tradition. But I got to tell you, on TV, he's a nice guy. He is a nice guy. Pat Buchanan honestly admitted that the voters in Florida didn't vote for him. His rock heart, his ideology is horrific, but he can put a very kind note on it. He can sit and laugh with, you know, Rachel Maddow. So listen when the host pushes Pat Buchanan on Michael Steele's apology, and how even Pat Buchanan, who wants to sound reasonable, who wants to sound normal, who wants to sound like someone who could have mainstream American views, how even he is forced to defend Rush Limbaugh.
Why, Pat? Why would Michael Steele say on Saturday night, look, I'm the de facto leader of the Republican Party, and then he goes on, runs back after Rush kind of went after him on his radio show, and Steele says, my intent was not to go after Rush. I have enormous respect for Rush Limbaugh. I was maybe a little bit inarticulate. There was no attempt on my part to diminish his voice or his leadership. What is it with Rush and these conservatives who go running back to him to kowtow?
Well, it didn't. Michael Steele made a mistake. It wasn't that Rush is an entertainer, which he certainly is, as well as a conservative voice. Michael Steele said that what he says is ugly and incendiary, which is a real insult. And having made that insult to someone who has an enormous voice, 20 million people or something, I think he was right to apologize. I regret Michael Steele did that. I think he's a good man. But this is a tiff, and I give the Democrats...
You got that? He doesn't regret that Michael Steele apologized. He regrets that Michael Steele said that Rush Limbaugh was ugly and incendiary. He regrets that Steele said that Limbaugh was ugly and incendiary because Limbaugh's got 20 million listeners. And, you know, if you have that kind of power, well, I guess it justifies anything you do. Well, you know, Pat, hundreds of millions voted for Obama. Well, so is Rush Limbaugh ugly and incendiary? Well, let's hear from the man himself.
They wanted him elected because they wanted to reassert their power. Power, the media here, in being able to sway public opinion to the result that they wanted. So it didn't. They were going to cover up the Jeremiah Wright, all these things that give indication of radicalism in Obama, cover that up, portray him as he wants to be portrayed, somebody who's not to be questioned, somebody who's not to be doubted. We're just supposed to accept and trust.
Somebody who's not to be questioned? Someone who's not to be doubted? Someone to accept and trust? Is that President Obama? Who went three times to the Republican caucus meeting of the House, even though he got no votes for his stimulus package? Not to be questioned, not to be doubted. The man who invites people in his cabinet, you know, the campaign of rivals, cabinet of rivals that Abraham Lincoln set up. I don't know what dream world Rush Limbaugh is living in. But let's go on and listen to whether anything he says might be considered ugly or incendiary.
Because most of these guys came alive and came of age in the civil rights battles of the 60s. It defines who they are. They've trained the young drive-bys to look at events through the same prism. You know, racism in this country is an exclusive province of the left. We're witnessing racism all this week that led up to the inauguration. We are being told that we have to hope he succeeds, that we have to bend over, grab the ankles, bend over forward, backward, whichever, because his father was black, because this is the first black president. We've got to accept this.
Did you hear that? We're being told that we have to hope he succeeds, that we have to bend over, grab the ankles. Thank you for the graphic design of someone being raped. Because his father was black. Really? Really? Is that what the media is saying? Take your strongest Obama defender, David Plouffe, David Axelrod. They're telling America you have to accept every word he says on faith because he's black? I don't recall people saying that. I don't recall Jesse Jackson saying that. He certainly gave him a hard time. I don't recall Al Sharpton saying that. Who's saying that, Rush? Who's saying that? Who are they? in the chat room their last thing at the idea that they covered up Reverend Wright. Yeah, I don't remember anyone covering up Reverend Wright. As I recall, virtually everyone mentioned it at every point that they could. So clearly this is the voice of a paranoid, insecure, addiction-riddled madman. Well, madman's a dangerous word. Let's not assume he's insane. Let's assume he's just trying to be an incendiary entertainer. But you see, the fascinating thing is not that Rush Limbaugh exists. There's always going to be bloviating people saying extreme things on the air. Or just bloviating people saying extreme things. What's fascinating is not Limbaugh's existence. I wouldn't do a story on him if it were just him bloviating. What's fascinating is the apologies. The way the Republicans recognize him as their overlord. From members of Congress to Michael Steele, the head of the Republican Party, to Pat Buchanan, who ran for president and is a voice in the conservative movement. They've all got to pay their dues. They've got to pay their dues to Rush Limbaugh. Why? Well, to help explain, I'm going to play another right-wing clip. I'll probably play more right-wing clips this hour than you'll ever hear from me again. Because what's fascinating about this is that the right admits it to be true. As much as there's a few half-hearted denials, oh no, Rush Limbaugh isn't really our leader. As soon as someone says, what? Rush Limbaugh's not your leader? Immediately they go and they bow and they scrape and they kiss his ring and they kiss his ass. Interestingly, the Republicans know he is their leader. They know it. And they admit it when they're talking amongst themselves. This is a clip on, yes, The Factor. Bill O'Reilly on Fox News talking with a reporter from The Washington Times. And if you don't know what The Washington Times is, you should. In Washington, D.C., there is a very large, credible newspaper called The Washington Post. It's been around for a very long time. And then there's a newspaper that loses millions of dollars a year, funded entirely by a man who has declared himself to be the Messiah, Reverend Sun Myung Moon. Yes, the founder of the cult that led to the Moonies, that led to young people being taken off the street and denied protein and forced into mass marriages with strange sexual practices. I won't give all those details. I've done them on another show. But this crazy billionaire, cult-leading, messianic complex guy, Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who claims he talks to Jesus and Hitler daily, must be interesting conversations, bought the Washington Times so he could have influence in Washington. And even though nobody buys it and nobody reads it, well, he funnels millions of dollars into it so it stays afloat. And he has a whole host of conservative reporters who write on his newspaper to try to give it the patina of influence, the patina of acceptability. Patina is a great word. I've used a lot today. Patina, of course, is a covering, usually a false covering, a shiny covering for something that's rotten underneath. So here is a conversation between Bill O'Reilly and a reporter for the Washington Times. And the fascinating thing about this conversation is how much they admit that Rush Limbaugh is their true leader. Listen in.
So, look, I don't know which party is more chaotic at this point. You got a radio talk show host, powerful guy, Rush Limbaugh, calling a lot of shots in the Republican Party, it seems. And the Steele obviously didn't like it or doesn't like it, doesn't want to get in a fight with Rush Limbaugh. That would be suicide for him. So what do you think?
Well, I think that Steele is the head of the Republican Party and Rush Limbaugh is the head of the conservative cause in this country. I think Steele made a mistake by throwing Rush under the bus. Rush came back and unloaded all over Steele and showed that Steele was probably punching above his weight class. Steele then apologized, and both of them are trying to put it behind them. But what's interesting about this dispute, Bill, is...
Before he says what's interesting, note that he says that Steele tried to punch above his weight class. The head of the Republican Party was punching above his weight class. He didn't even belong in the ring with the real leader of the Republican Party. I mean, think about this. While George Bush was in office, We had a leader of our Democratic Party. His name was Howard Dean. Is there anyone, any Democrat, any entertainer, that if Howard Dean attacked, they would say, well, it's not in his weight class? Let's take, I don't know, Oprah, perhaps the most powerful entertainer in America. Even Oprah, I can't imagine someone saying, well, Howard Dean, you know, he shouldn't have attacked Oprah. She's not in his weight class. And that's Oprah, who isn't really a political figure that often. But the when the head of the Republican Party can't even be in the same ring as Rush Limbaugh, you know who's king, and you know who's duke. You know who outranks who. You know who is the overlord and who is the vassal. You know who runs the Republican Party. Listen to more of this discussion.
That when Steele talked about Rush Limbaugh, he talked about ugly, he talked about incendiary, he talked about he's an entertainer. All of those criticisms were about style or tone, not about substance. In other words, Steele and Rush don't represent some sort of fundamentally different and disagreeing factions within the right, you know, on issues like, you know, gun control or taxes or abortion or, you know, the march towards socialism. They're basically on the same side on 80-90% of the issue.
They're basically on the same side. This is no liberal claim. The right admits it. The right wing admits it. Limbaugh is their leader. If there's one thing that the right and the left can agree on, and there's not much, it's that Rush Limbaugh is the leader of the Republican Party. Listen to Bill O'Reilly confirm the same thing.
The thing that gives people who don't follow politics closely and really don't know what's going on is that Michael Steele obviously is apologizing to Rush Limbaugh, that Rush Limbaugh is more powerful than Steele, and Limbaugh may well be. He may well be.
He may well be. We'll move on.
He probably is. I mean, you know, RNC chairmen come and go. Rush Limbaugh is a constant in the American conservative movement.
The question becomes, who's running the Republican Party? Who's the most powerful person within the Republican Party? Who's shaping how the party behaves?
Well, I would say, you know, again, you're getting into semantics here. I mean, again, I think Rush is the head of the conservative cause. He happens to be a Republican, so I would say that he's the most influential Republican. Michael Steele's the head of the Republican Party.
But,
you know,
is it wise for a Republican Party to have a radio talk show host as the most powerful person in it? Is that a good thing?
I think it is a good thing. I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to have Rush Limbaugh articulating. I mean, Rush Limbaugh is way more than an entertainer. He is a fearless, unapologetic advocate of conservatism. And he's not constrained by what politicians basically can't say certain things. Rush can just let it fly.
If Rush Limbaugh ran for president next time, would he win?
I don't think so. I don't, again, he's not a politician. He is a spokesman. He's the leader of a movement and of a cause.
Here's what I'm getting at. If Rush Limbaugh ran for president and he didn't win, okay, couldn't get the plurality of the nation behind him for whatever reason, but he is now the signature voice of the Republican Party. It seems to me the Republican Party's got some problems. It looks leaderless. It looks rudderless. That's what it looks like. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think right now the Republican Party is casting about for its next generation of leaders. They got their clocks cleaned in 2006 and in 2008.
Right, so there is disarray a couple people in the party.
This is fascinating stuff here. You have Bill O'Reilly and the Mooney newspaper guy, and they agree that the Republican Party has no other leader but Rush Limbaugh, right? There is no God but Limbaugh, or there's no God but money, and Limbaugh is his prophet. They admit it. And yet, they're afraid to disown him, because they know that if they do, they're going to have to be like going to the mafia godfather, right? They're going to have to be on bended knee, and they're going to have to apologize to this guy. I mean, even Bobby Jindal, Piyush Jindal, Piyush, quote, Bobby, unquote, Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, who doesn't want to use his Indian name because he fears that Republicans won't elect anyone who uses his real ethnic name. Even he bows down to Rush Limbaugh, right? This is a direct quote from Jindal on the Larry King show. He plays a clip from Rush Limbaugh. And Jindal says, this is likely the next candidate for president for the Republicans. He says, look, clearly the American people are worried about paying their mortgages, keeping their jobs, and paying their health care bills. I think Rush is a great leader for conservatives. I think he articulates what a lot of people are concerned about. Let's just put aside the fact that Rush Limbaugh doesn't want to do anything about helping people pay their mortgages or keep their jobs or pay their health care bills. He's against all that. I guess Governor Jindal's a little bit confused on it. So Larry King asked Governor Jindal, do you want Obama to fail? And Jindal responds, I don't want those policies to be adopted. I want my country to succeed, but I don't want those policies to be adopted. And King says, and Larry King is not normally a strong interviewer, he says, what if the policies work? And Jindal says, well, again. And King says, what if they work? And Jindal says, this is where we have a fundamental disagreement. I don't think it's going to work. He also goes on then to ask whether Jindal was happy that Steele apologized. And Jindal said, I'm glad he apologized. I think the chairman's a breath of fresh air, and Rush is a leader for conservatives. He articulates blah, 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 blah. So everyone's bowing down to him. Everyone's bowing down to Rush. You have the leader of the Republican Party. You have the putative nominee for president of the United States. All of them are bowing down to a guy who represents the id, if you will. The guy that once said that feminism is all about unattractive women getting dates, and actually a lot worse things, coined the term feminazis. And I mean, I don't think I have to tell you all the ridiculous things he said, the right-wing conspiracy theories that Bill Clinton killed Vince Foster, that came from Rush Limbaugh. I've already played for you the clip about people have to grab their ankles because he's black. He is the one who condemned anyone who opposed the war in Iraq as being anti-American. I'm reading a whole list here, which is, I guess, why I'm slow, because there's so many different things. Of course, there's the claim that Michael J. Fox was faking his Parkinson's disease. This is a nasty person. This is a nasty person. And Sophie asks in the chat room, I think, a very good question. She says to me, and I'll read it if she doesn't mind. What is the obsession with Rush Limbaugh, Mark? Why is every single liberal radio host playing Rush tapes every day? Why? I'll tell you why. Maybe I can explain in the last 3 minutes here. It's not because of Rush. It's because of how the Republicans and the conservatives treat Rush. I don't know that I've played a single clip from Rush Limbaugh in my 5 years on radio. Maybe I have one or two. I certainly never devoted an entire show to him till now. But because he is the Republican leader, what I've tried to show throughout this broadcast is not just the extreme things he says, right? There's another performance artist, a woman with long blonde hair whose name I do my best never to mention on this show, who says even more extreme things. But she, at least, the Republican Party can distance itself from her, and therefore I don't do shows about her. She's just a minstrel act. She is a performance artist. She's like those people that put human excrement all over themselves and say, look at me, look at me, look at me. No, I don't talk about her. But the reason I'm talking about Rush is precisely because the head of the Republican Party is begging him for forgiveness. Precisely because members of Congress who say they want to give President Obama a chance are voting 100%, at least in the House, no on his plan because of Rush Limbaugh's influence. Because Pat Buchanan, a strong voice in and of himself, can't distance himself from Rush Limbaugh. Bill O'Reilly can't distance himself from Rush Limbaugh. Sean Hannity can't. The Washington Times can't. Bobby Jindal, the Republican candidate for President of the United States, the leader, he can't. And what does that tell you? It tells you how far off the planet the Republican Party is now. Usually when a party is handed their hat, is soundly defeated in two separate elections, in 2006 and 2008, they run back to the center, they move to the center, they try to reach out to moderates, not this Republican Party. To the extent that they try, Rush Limbaugh ropes them right back in like the godfather that he is. Even to the extent that Michael Steele wanted to distance himself from Rush Limbaugh. Gotta go back and apologize. And that's my point. He is the leader of the Republican Party. He represents all they stand for. And he's going down in flames. I hope you enjoyed the show. This is Mark Levine, signing off.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It may feel like a Monday to me, or a Thursday, or a Tuesday, or God knows what. It seems like I've been away for a month. Golly Moses, I missed you guys. I'm telling you. I had a really enjoyable time at Power Shift 2009 in Washington, D.C., along with the whole fam family. Ferg was there, Doodle was there, Margie was there, Agnes was there. We all had a wonderful, wonderful time. And I hope you got to check out some of the speeches from Friday evening's opening session. It was quite exciting. I think you might want to check out Van Jones's remarks in particular. Unfortunately, we had an internet burp along about the time that former Salt Lake City, Utah Mayor Rocky Anderson had 12,000. Of America's future, America's youth, chanting in unison, there's no such thing as clean coal, there's no such thing as clean coal. Later on, clean coal was compared to unicorn-powered automobiles. Yeah, the message went through loud and clear. We'll talk a little bit more about that trip. And the fact that I'm still getting feeling back in the tips of my fingers from the brutally cold weather on Monday. But what an amazing event that act of civil disobedience was. Exciting to see the future of America standing up and demanding realistic change away from the screw-ups that my and previous generations have imposed upon them and their future via the nasty, nasty, nasty utilization of the world's filthiest fuel source, namely, to wit, heretofore, therefore, and whereas, coal. It was exciting indeed. And people from so many different places, meeting the American Indian groups from Black Mesa, folks from Alaska come to talk about what coal is doing to their communities. Folks from all over the Southeast talking about what mountaintop removal does, what coal-fired power plants do to their communities. From the Midwest, from the Upper Midwest, from the Mountain West, from the West Coast itself.
Remember, all that Black Mesa coal from Arizona is mixed with water. You know, Arizona's largely desert and doesn't have a lot of water. But that's okay. Peabody Energy takes what little water there is and mixes it with ground-up coal and shoots it through a pipeline to a power plant that then burns it for holy. In a place where it's always sunny! But never mind. But anyway, it was all magnificent, and we'll talk about it later. So, yeah, it feels like Monday, it feels like Tuesday, it feels like God only knows. So, but we got a normal week for the rest of the week and a normal week next week, so hot diggity. But it's not just my first day back. It's not just the middle of the week. It's not just Wednesday. No, it's not hump day. Not downhill to Friday. No, brothers and sisters, hallelujah, it is prayer meeting Wednesday. Glory, choir master, fire it up.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Hallelujah, brothers and sisters! Till I spend stars with a vaccinated with a shamble of a ding dong, I love you. It is prayer meeting. Come on down, the doors of the Cathedral of Common Sense are open. I am Bishop Bob Kincaid. I got my fancy little bishopin' hat on and my bishopin' robes. Come on down the blood-red carpet and come down to the altar and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense flowing through you. Glory! Hallelujah! Ho! This being prayer meeting and all, gotta have a good story to get us started. And I got one. It's been sitting around for a while because we haven't had a chance to get together like this for our usual congregatory. Whew, how's that for a $10 word, brothers and sisters? Congregatory meetings. But yes, we go to I can use the $10 words. I just can't say the $1 ones. Cresaptown, Maryland. That's where we go, one way or the other. And in Cresaptown, Maryland, we find good, upstanding, righteous, God-fearing ex-barber Joe Godlewski. Joe Godlewski apparently likes to watch the Food Channel and such a little bit, and he's forever seeing them fancy chefs a-pouring some of that there kosher salt onto their hands and a-dumping it on their food. But Joe Godlewski, he's a Christian man, and he didn't like that kosher salt all the time a-being pushed about on unwitting viewers. So Joe Godlewski
he did something about it. Joe Godlewski has introduced and trademarked Blessed Christian Salt. And it will be available from Memphis, Tennessee-based Ingredients Corporation of America. Really? You've got a corporation and that's the best you can come up with? Ingredients Corporation? Ingredients Corporation of America will indeed be marketing Blessed Christian Salt. He's got an Episcopal priest who will bless it on the way to the capitalist commerce stream. I know, irony, it's lost on these daggum fundies, but what are you going to do? And never mind the fact that kosher salt is not named, it's kosher, you know, it's not named kosher salt because there's any, it's not like there's a rabbi up there going, I bless the salt, I bless the salt, I bless the salt, I bless the salt. No! It's kosher because to kosher something is a cooking term! Koshering! Also known, anybody ever eat corned beef? Shh, don't tell the fundies, but there's no corn in corned beef. To corn something is to salt something away as a preserving process. It is called corning because the grains of salt... Come on, rock salt. If you live where it snows or ices, you've thrown it on the driveway, right? Chunky! Like grain! And therefore, it is to corn beef is to use corns of salt. See, the word corn predates maize, which is... And we call it maize. Yeah, you know what I mean. So, all of this is lost on a fundy like Joe Godlewski. Joe Godlewski probably, apparently has some grain, corn perhaps, of hateful racial bias hiding somewhere down in his Christian soul. And that's right, he's offended by the concept of that unchristian salt. And he sees an opportunity, frankly, to make a dollar out of it. Sure. Why not? Blessed Christian salt. Salt's just as good as that kosher salt, but you can use this and still get into heaven. Yeah, Joe Godlewski has seen the future open before him, this retired barber. God, I hope there's no salt, no hair in the salt. But we did that story a couple of weeks ago, and it's the dinner hour, and I won't do that to you again. If the salt takes off, if the salt flies, he's already got plans for a whole line of blessed Christian foods. Anybody here ever read Robert A. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land? The Fosterite religion? Hello? Just checking. Because, you know, the church has always been good at branding stuff. From architecture to paintings to liquor. Yeah. Frangelico, remember? But Agnes loves Frangelico. I mean, not that she's, you know, sitting around drinking it through a straw, but, yeah. No, she's almost the ultimate teetotaler, but if she, I'd like a little bit of Frangelico, please. You know, like Mrs. Butterworth's is in the syrup bottle that's shaped like Mrs. Butterworth. Well, Frangelico is in a bottle that's shaped like a fryer. There you go. Sure. Exactly. So we start this evening with Blessed Christian Salt, because Joe Godlewski has a religious objection to kosher salt. Yeesh. And this made the news. Yeah, I know. And Bob, why are you talking about it? Because it's prayer meeting, and it's funny, and pointing out the stupidity of fundamentalists. You know? I mean, he's got an Episcopal priest doing the blessing, so I guess he's not a hardcore... But somebody somewhere along the way should have disabused it. I mean, in fact, if you get right down to it, and I think... either of our two resident experts on things pertaining to the Jewish faith could tell you that all salt is kosher salt. It's a mineral salt, you know, a mineral. I mean, it just is. Now, I don't know what would happen to Joe Godlewski if you explained to him that even if he gets it blessed by a priest and calls it blessed Christian salt, it's still kosher. Well, he knows the field's rules, and he'll never smarten up the chumps. Ethel, I think we'd better order us some of that blessed Christian salt. You know, I haven't seen that precious Paula Deen, and she uses that kosher salt. I wonder if she knows her soul's in turmoil. Ugh, fundies. And meanwhile, in Italy, a priest is suggesting, get this, a priest is suggesting that people give up texting for Lent. That young people stop text messaging each other for Lent. Apparently, and he's focusing this on Italy. Yeah, no. None of that giving up, because this is all 40 days, Lent's 40 days long, right? And it is a mimicry of the 40 days that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Nazarene carpenter, spent fasting in the desert. So this Italian priest wants young people to give up text messaging. Yeah, never mind spending 40 days working for the poor. Never mind spending 40 days... No. Never mind spending 40 days feeding the hungry, housing the homeless. Quit text messaging each other. Because that's going to change the world. You stop it. What are you wearing? Could somebody tell Bishop, whatever his name is, over in Leghorn or Genoa or wherever, that text messaging isn't the reason that the church is losing its younger generation, that it has something to do with hypocrisy and, you know, watching an entire continent die because a hateful old ex-anti-aircraft gunner for the Nazis says that African men can't have a little latex thingy on there, you know, to keep from spreading the HIV virus and burning up an entire continent. Could somebody get that message to the bishop? Maybe you could text message him, the bishop, because he didn't say he wanted the young people to give up the text messaging, so maybe you could text message Bishop What's-His-Face. But that's me, and I'm crazy. So, you know, just a couple of fun things. A couple of fun things to get us started this evening on prayer meeting. There are an abundance of topics out there for the rest of the evening. And something I didn't get around to last time we talked, which was, I think, what was that? When, it was a week ago. I want to play you a couple of tracks or at least a track this evening from Jason Isbell's new album, Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit. There are a couple of particularly trenchant tracks I think you'll enjoy. But for now, however, since it has been a while since we have talked, we're going to go straight to the phone lines. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, see, we do have a chin-dop-da. I love you. Mecca Lecca, hi, Brother Bob.
Hey, Brother Albert, what's happening?
Oh, man, I'll tell you what, I missed you. I really did. What the hell kind of Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. That's all I can say regarding.
I know. I leave and all the fun stories happen.
It's actually beautiful. It's just like implosions, and it's like the Death Star blowing up. It's gorgeous.
Do you realize I was in D.C. at the same time that Flimball was babbling to CPAC? You know, the irony was not lost on me, Albert. At the same time that Flimball was babbling to CPAC, you know, to that assembled horde of old, pasty, doughy white people who are on their way out,
mm-hmm.
12,000 young people who are on their way in were at the Washington Convention Center rejecting every last thing that conservatives and right-wingers and repiglicans that they stand for. It was like the rise of humanity and the disappearing dinosaurs. Goodbye. Goodbye, old dinosaurs. Goodbye. And there's Flimball, who was supposed to, what was he, supposed to speak for 15 minutes, and he turned it into a Castro-like hour and some odd oration. And did you see the footage, Albert, of him up there the bouncing and jiggling like some sort? Oh, my God, it was, yeesh.
Yeah, that was one thing I was kind of, I kept my palate clean because I knew that was coming up. I didn't watch The Little Kid until today, and I didn't watch a lot of that because I knew that it was going to take some fortitude and some purity of heart in order to get through some of Flush Flimball's. Oh, he's just such a scat muncher, this guy. I mean, when he called, saying that he has a psychosis regarding, you know, it's a psychosis regarding because it's about emotions, and talking about money and spending other, like all these people, like he was, it was so transparent, it was so obvious as to who he works for and what he works for, and it's just, I mean, he's just disgusting. It's just week after week after week after week, the words just fly out of my mouth. I just. These people are just stupefying. It's ridiculous. It's unreal.
Yeah, it is. And look, let's get one thing clear. And I really think this is sort of the Zen bottom line, where Flimball is concerned. And I put this in the chat room. I don't know if you'd popped in yet. Do you know why Flush Flimball says, "I hope he fails"? Because he can't get away with saying, "I hope he dies."
Yeah.
It's more, and it needs to be recognized for what it is. That business is more right-wing eliminationist rhetoric, and we have got to learn to identify it when we hear it and when we see it. And that's exactly what it is. Flush Flimball still hates the fact that, you know, that one is in the White House. You know, one of those people.
Yeah.
And it's driving him nuts. And he every day he hopes, he wants, no kidding, I mean, he does, he wants Barack Obama off the planet. But he can't say it on the air. Because that would be a hate too far for him. So instead, he speaks to his the little scrape-knuckle audience in the code that they can understand. Just like his audience understands what he's talking about when he calls Rahm Emanuel a ballerina. Just like they understood what he was talking about when he called John Edwards the brick girl. It's code.
It's very transparent code. I mean, and I hear what you're saying, like, you know, he really couldn't, I don't know what other thing he could say other than wants him to fail or he's an enemy of the country, which is pretty much the kinds of things that, you know, the Republicans have been yammering about. Is, you know, they talk, oh, he's the enemy of the country and he's going to destroy the country and this is not what we want and this is this and this and this. And they just have such a detachment from reality that, yeah, we have dinos that have on our side that have done some pretty stupid things. But, you know, I mean, what's going to wind up happening is, you know, everybody's going to have to, you know, come into a reality where the middle round is that's going to have to be the right wing, because the right wing has completely lost their it's like soul paying time. I mean, this is like, you know, they've been racking up, you know, bad karma for years and years and years and years and years. All these things and all this hatred is just bubbling up inside them. You can't even contain it. It's crazy. It's just, I mean, imagine 4 years ago. Do you think that they'd be in the place that they were now? Back when Ari Fleischer could sit there and tell straight-faced, bold lies while our worst paranoias of, you know, federal government overstepping its boundaries and all this other stuff, and, you know, martial law and all these things. All this stuff is just right.
Yeah, why do you think the right wing has to talk about all this foolishness? Because you know what? That story, which is on in the stack for tonight, thank you for bringing it up. Everything that we said that we were afraid of under the reign of dim leader, it was true. They really were planning to overturn our constitutional form of government. And now they've been caught. You know, I mean, the Obama administration released those memos, and now we know, we see, and while we scream, you know, while we holler about how, you know, we want them prosecuted, the American people know now what level of requirement, Albert, what level of duty attaches to the American people ourselves in the face of knowledge that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, that whole filthy fascist crowd was bent on trying, and we, my God, we were in a hair's breadth of it happening.
Yep.
What level of responsibility attaches to us if we do not run these people to earth and prosecute and detain and imprison them?
Exactly. Oh, it's exactly right. I mean, I really don't. I don't even think it's like such a big blow. What just transpired, was it Friday? Was when we found out about this. I think it's been such a big blow, and there has been so much other, you know, Twitter fluff and all this other stuff. Even though, granted, you got to get it this far. The Twitter fluff that's out there now is a lot more pertaining to our reality. I mean, at least I'm not seeing anything about Kevin Federline and Britney Spears and all this other junk, whereas we didn't, you know, back when Bush first took office and all the kind of, you know, fluff in the media and the whole, you know, celebrity worship type culture that we had going. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's a little bit of that, but, you know, I think it's primarily issues. I mean, you know, as Sophie did mention in terms to Mark's show last hour that, you know, she's sick of hearing about Rush Limbaugh, but my goodness gracious. At least this cockroach is out of the shadows. He's out of the darkness. We can sit there, find him, and go, and get rid. I mean, and literally say, "Look at this. This is what you want to. This is where you want to go. This is where we're going." I mean, look at what happened over this weekend. Where the stock market's dropping like a, you know, like a meteor out of space. And you know, and who's responsible for this? Phil Graham and all these other criminals. What did Bush and these guys do? Oh my God, they're trying to overthrow the government, and then all their buddies are sitting there stealing. And, you know, making, just eroding the culture like a freaking termites, you know, to a wooden foundation of a building. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, the way the level, I think the level of crime hasn't even been comprehended. It's so big.
No, this
so
is tip bad. Of the iceberg stuff, Albert.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Bush, George Bush's name will be a boogeyman in 400 years. He would be, I mean, especially if we don't do anything and we just sit there and allow it to continue and then, you know, revert back to the dark ages for another third or fourth time. If we're going to do that as a civilization, then, well, you know, he would certainly be a boogeyman in that, you know, for the future. But, you know, hopefully we will sit there and go, oh my God, we do some fixing. And we do some, you know, I mean, I loved your video, your song that you wrote. That was, you know, I'll never hear that song again without thinking about that and the chorus and however and all the lyrics that you put into that song. I mean, that song is never again what it used to be to me. Talking about Country Road.
Yeah.
You know, just fantastic stuff. And I mean, just, you know, like, I think that such a, you know, video like that has such a soul to it that, you know, maybe wasn't even alive and, you know, for a massive consumption, you know, in 2001. You know, I think that, you know, people are not going to want to, you know, people that don't know, and that's the whole thing, you know, people that we start waking up, we don't know what's going on in West Virginia. You know, we don't pay attention because it's so, we don't pay it. You know, I mean, you look at where I live, you know, the big city near me is 30 miles away, I mean, 30 minutes away, and they act like it's, you know, across the country to come visit, you know. But, you know, I think that we're starting to kind of open our eyes to this, you know, local food. You'd never believe the amount of people that I talk to about these things that I don't think would have even cared about these things in 2001. And all of a sudden, people start caring about this kind of stuff. You know, if they're going to take, if they're going to care about the food they're going to eat locally, then they're going to care about the air they breathe and the water they drink and with the land that they have to look at and raise children on and this and this and that. And I mean, I don't see no future in clean coal and these guys. And I mean, you can't carbon capture such a freaking fantasy. I mean, we don't. If we had that kind of technology, we wouldn't have to worry about creating kind of. You know what I'm saying? If we had a ability to stick carbon into something that was useful or benign, and then we would have no problem. We could be going to different planets in space. I mean, that's the kind of technology we'd need to have. What are you going to do? Get a straw out to space and pump it up out of the big smokestack? Oh, what a freaking what a character that would be, huh? Oh my God!
I know. And
with a green, black cloud around it, and pipes coming out of it, blowing off more stuff. Ridiculous.
Right? Yeah. With the never mind the elevator to space. We've got to build a smokestack to space. But then, what happens to the smoke in a zero G environment? And you know what? I'll find out. Somebody will tell me. I bet you.
It'll make the atmosphere a little bigger. We'll probably see bigger electrical storms. It'll be awesome.
Oh, we'll start looking like Usel's homeworld.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have those. And kosher salt is delicious, by the way.
That's all we use. I mean, because,
It's not, just to explain to nobody who, you know, someone who doesn't know, if you have, like, the iodized table salt, it's too salty. The kosher salt is, like, the right amount of salt for some reason. It's not as sharp. It's not as, I mean, you know, you can overdo it, but for the most part, it's, that's the stuff to use. What the hell are they talking? Well, it's to me, I would imagine.
But no, it's Wednesday and it's prayer meeting and it's an opportunity to fleece the faithful.
It's like, I would imagine that the kosher way of making salt that comes in my box of kosher salt is process to it. I mean, not that it's blessed or anything. And since when are these people throwing out? Well, when are fundies throwing out the Old Testament? I mean, if it's kosher, isn't that Christian? And this, they don't even know where the hell they are. They're so lost and scattered. I mean, it's ridiculous. The fights that they're having, they're talking about, I read a really disturbing comment on somebody talking about, we won Prop 8, blah, 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 blah. The Colorado congressman. Did you happen to hear that cretin, that religious?
Which there was a guy in Utah and then there was a guy in Colorado, and they're both equally hateful and insane. And, the Colorado guy, what was he? Was being gay, was it an abomination for him, or was it a sin against God? I can't remember. You know, there's so many.
Yeah. This is like completely, I mean, you know who you're making me think of? You're making me think of that other guy. You said abomination, and it made me think of that reverend from Harlem.
Oh, yeah, the one that went after
He's calling Obama the next Hitler.
Oh, he hasn't gone away yet? Nobody told him his 15 minutes were up?
No. Now he's talking about how he's gay because it was that Larry Sinclair stuff's coming now. Remember we talked about that?
Yeah.
I can't believe they waited so long, but it's here. So, yay, Larry Sinclair's here, and he's on the news, and we'll see what happens with this. Most likely it's just going to be laughed at because it's so freaking desperate. I mean, I mean, it's like socialist. What do they call them? They call them radical liberal. Well, that didn't work. Oh, you're socialist. Oh, that didn't work.
But that's okay. Jim Cramer's out on CNBC now talking about the President Obama and waving around a picture of Lenin.
How many times can you be caught? And I'm just using this as a general symbolism for these people. How many times can the banker get caught with his hand in the frickin' jar, and then they assume that every time we play Monopoly every day that they're going to still be in charge? I don't even know why people in charge. I mean, the people that, Rush Limbaugh likes to talk about, Quirk and Michael Savage talking over here about, liberalism is a mental disorder, and Jonah Goldberg rewriting history and just contaminating filth and all this other junk that it does stick to some of the duller dullards among us and the greedy. But, you know, when they sit there and they're talking about such nonsense, I don't know. It gives me a freaking aneurysm. It just gives me an aneurysm to sit there and imagine the crap that these people are trying. It's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
Well, it is a crime, and there's nothing more ridiculous to get back to one of the other topics you raised. At what point in time does some bar organization in this country make sure that John Yoo never gets to lawyer again?
Oh please! Oh,
now let's establish the standard first. Bill Clinton lied about consensual oral sex and was disbarred for it. John Yoo, on the other hand, lied about the meaning of the Constitution of the United States and actively advocated for the abrogation of the entire Bill of Rights. And he's a constitutional law scholar at Bolt Hall School of Law on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley.
Yeah, which is,
why does that man have a law license, Albert?
You know, he might have a law license, but I don't really think he has a single ounce of respect. I mean, I don't think he has a drop. I don't think he has an iota. I mean,
listen to his words. This is a quote.
No, he's a filthy degenerate.
He is.
A hideous person.
Anybody who would write this is. First Amendment speech and press rights may also be subordinated to the overriding need to wage war successfully. He further advocated that the Fourth Amendment would not apply in domestic military operations that were in themselves in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. This man, you know, granted, he looks like he probably bathes daily and all those important things. This man is a monster. It is obvious from his legal so-called analysis that inside this man's skull lay the seeds itching to sprout of genocides and crimes against humanity, of tyranny and dictatorship, of everything that this country stands against. That man stands for, and the state, and he's licensed in Pennsylvania, and the state of Pennsylvania still allows him to besmirch its legal licensing process by holding a law license when this man was absolutely advocating in places where it mattered, Albert, advocating the complete overthrow of the Constitution of the United States.
Yep, and the shredding of the Declaration of Independence and all that jazz. And he wants to make Bush a little puppet, dictator, and he's a Goebbels. I mean, and he may not have been writing, probably, but he's sitting there paving the way. He's an Eichmann or whatever you want to call him. He's one of these kind of, little evil, banality of evil kind of people. That
little Eichmann.
Exactly. I mean, he sits there and does these things, and I mean, he's maybe a little bit more malicious. He really kind of, I think he wants some blood. But, I mean, I don't think for long that people like him will be able to practice. I mean, when they talk about ethics, this is the thing that blows my mind. When you talk about ethics, okay, now I know ethics, there's a huge difference between, being ethical and being moral, okay? But ethics are bigger than morality. And ethics are even more all-encompassing. And if upholding the chief main law, the Constitution, all right? I understand. You said that there's the Constitution. You can fit it all on one really big page, And if you want to break it down into a book, it's what, 40 pages, those little booklets, whatever they are?
Yeah.
Okay? All right. And then you look at, you know, the law books, you know, and yeah, there's case law and this and that, but then there's all these penal laws, and then and law gets into this, you know, just mountains of books. And, you know, I'm sure any lawyer can tell you, I got friends that are going in San Francisco, going to law school right now, and see, that's all she does, is read these books, read these laws, all these things. Now, if they're going to sit there, right, if the Constitution is the main law, how the hell are you going to try to sit there and try to find some clause or here and there and this and this and the, some vague nonsense so you can sit there and try to... I don't even know where he tried to justify this. I mean, obviously some was absolutely 100% wrong and they shouldn't have done it because they went out and, nobody pay attention to this memo. No, nobody looked behind the curtain at this memo, right? Remember? Didn't they just do that like 3 days before Bush is out of office? They sat there and they made that memos and his little additions. They said, oh, no, nobody pay attention. Like, we never did any of this. You know, it was all a dream. This didn't happen. You know, these are not the droids you're looking for. And that's essentially this nonsense that these guys try to throw up this flack. It's just, I don't think it's effective. I don't think it's going to work. I think people are too awake, too consciously aware of maybe, you know, oh my God, are you really telling me that there was some justification to my fear? That little tween that I felt in my stomach every time I heard talking about this kind of system, you know, closed circuit cameras being put in or, you know, fences and all these other components to, you know, these little things. Oh my God, I had something to really worry about. I'm not just some tinfoil hat conspiracy theory because I'm worried about these approaches I'm seeing.
Scott Horton, who turns out is an excellent, excellent writer, by the way, has an article over at Harper's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a good analysis. It's called George W. Bush's Disposable Constitution. I recommend it for anyone who is so inclined. Harpers.org, and then just it was published yesterday. He has one line in there that just gives me the chills. He says, "We may not have realized it at the time, but in the period from late 2001 to January 19th, 2009, this country was a dictatorship." It was. And see, this puts paid to one other thing, Albert, and that is this. You know how the right-wingers were running around, and some of them still, well, see, we don't know how many attacks George Bush protected us against. Remember that? You've heard that.
Yeah.
Well, this proves that number is precisely zero. That there were no attempts. Not that there were no, not that they stymied it. There were no attempts. To the extent that he wanted it, Osama bin Laden got everything that he wanted, Albert.
Exactly. Well, exactly. But then so did the Bush administration.
Because, if there had been an attack, all of this would have been put into play.
It would have, but I don't know if they'd want to take it. I mean, in a sense, you know, now we're going to have to talk about who does what and who tells, you know, who knows what when. You know, what when and where. You know, I mean, if you think about it, okay, Osama bin Laden is an independent entity. Right. Well, it doesn't make tactical sense to continue to try to throw, you know, these little squads of men do these things that are, you know, obviously create miracles. You know, that kind of thing for the kind of retaliation that he got exactly what he wanted. But Osama bin Laden wanted, what did he want? He wanted U.S. forces out of Saudi Arabia. He wanted, get us mired in a war on two fronts or something along those lines, invade another Arab nation. And then what was the third one? There was another one. You know, basically, you know, bring its economy to its knees, which is why the towers were symbolically attacked. Okay. So, he got every single one. Osama bin Laden, I bet he can get some stuff done as president. Because you look at what he's doing from a cave. My God. I mean, how the hell does anyone fall into a trap that, well,
I know.
The kind of times you ever make a blunder like that is when you set it yourself. And you walk into your own claymore or your own needle in the carpet. I mean,
wow.
I just, you know. Yeah, I've done that, stupid idiot. As
hurts
a kid.
A
but
lot.
Anyway, you know, I don't, you know, yeah, these guys.
Cocktail toothpicks are hell, too, by the way. Let me just say that.
Yeah, no doubt.
They break off. Little tiny punji sticks in the shag. Yuck. Mm-hmm. But no, I know exactly what you're saying, Albert. And you know, the other thing to be borne in mind is that right after September 11th, you know, Bin Laden put out a little memo saying, get the hell off of my sacred sand, talking about Saudi Arabia. George Bush promptly complied, and he never hit us again.
No. And, well, and then that's if you want to talk about, you know, he's an independent entity. If he's not, then I think in a sense, you know, I think it's quite possible that, yeah, you know, they write up all these laws. And what I would like to see, you know, prosecutions and, like, I don't know, could you call it book burnings? You know, because all these law books and these law theses and all these things that are just hideous.
No, no,
I know
what you're talking about.
Can we burn those?
No,
yeah.
Let me suggest.
Or just erase them.
No, let me suggest that we not. Let me suggest that we carve them in bronze.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
That or that.
And
yeah.
that we mount them on the walls of the penitentiary where we put these monsters. Okay? Because the thing that there's one thing at work here, and it's kind of, you know how the people who are always in favor of the death penalty are saying, well, you know, it certainly discourages murder, that death penalty. He'll never kill again. Now, before any of the little lurking right wingers flip out, I'm not advocating executing John Yoo. I don't advocate executing anybody. However,
he has to go to trial first. Anyway.
Right.
Let's not sentence him yet till we really discover all the things he's done.
But yeah, exactly. The point that I'm making, however, is that this, if we do not prosecute a monster like John Yoo, that we then leave these arguments of his floating around in the universe, for want of a better phrase. And somewhere down the road, some other little right-wing lawyer is going to pick it up and say, well, look, they didn't do anything to him for advocating this. That must mean we can.
Yeah, I mean, you know, essentially that they're like cleaning up these close coal slurry pits and, you know, getting the air and water clean and, you know, doing these things are important for future generations. Well, so is cleaning up this mind pollution. This depraved, you know, fascist type mentality, that kind of stuff, and leaving that stuff around is just as toxic as depleted uranium. You know, and that kind of stuff will impact you far more directly and every day, you know, feeling the boot in your face kind of way. You know, because if you think about it, you know, humanity is only going to get bigger and bigger, which means that the people that are going to be in charge are the ones that they're going to want to be able to control tighter and tighter. So if we allow these little, you know, Laputians to put these ropes around us, you know, as we start waking up, you know, it's our own damn fault in 60 years when, you know, everybody has a number codes on their freaking foreheads and, you know, buying creds and eating red bennies and, you know, bars and jets and cars and all this other crap. You know, I mean, if we'll be lucky to see a demolition man future or, you know, running man or any of those other crappy future.
I am the law.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and I'll tell you what, you know, as corny as some of those movies are, as corny as some of John Carpenter's movies are, they're scary because they're kind of accurate too. You know, you sit there and you watch Escape from New York and you see the background to what that movie's set in. You know, you look at the Escape from LA and everybody hated that movie, but if you look at that movie and the background that it's in and what the country looks like, there's a theocratic takeover of the freaking government. The president is now president for life. People are put when they're desirables, they're put into Los Angeles and New York into these Waldorf places. If they try to leave, they get killed. You know, if you sit there and you look at that, you know, people don't, I don't think, really take the whole movie and they go, oh, yeah, there's Kurt Russell surfing on a wave, you know, on a tidal wave, whatever the hell he's doing. I mean, you know, that's what they see with the movie, and they go, oh, look, he's got a cool gun and, you know, this and that. But, you know, the reality to the movie is, you know, is far more, you know,
go watch Blade Runner.
Go watch Blade Runner. Oh, watch all those. You know, not for nothing. I thought Arnold Schwarzenegger, he always disappointed me when I heard these things about him being a right-winger and a not. I always thought he knew better. Like, dude, didn't you read the plots to your own movies? Like, you know, what's wrong with you? I mean,
I only say the lines they tell me to say. I do not read the rest of the script. It is not in my contract.
Seriously, man. I mean, come on now. It's ridiculous.
Well, no, this the New York Times article and the Scott Horton article at Harper's all of this stuff about you is terrifying. It really is. I mean, to any, it is terrifying. I mean, this is John Carpenter movie stuff. It really, really is, Albert. Because,
exactly.
I mean, you know, well, a few minutes ago in our conversation, I mentioned the Posse Comitatus Act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that says that the military of the United States can never be used for law enforcement purposes inside the United States. Okay? Now, to me and you, that says you can't unleash the American military on the American people. Right? I mean, okay. That's fairly obvious.
It also says to me, I remember as a kid, I remember this actually striking me as something that made me love this country was when they told me about, you know, and you couldn't, because I grew up in New England, which obviously was, you know, headquartered and, I mean, you know, by all the, you know, British troops and stuff like that. So they kind of were subjugated in the ways that they were. And so they made the laws to counteract, like, oh my God, that really sucked. We don't want to ever have to do that ever again. Troops are not allowed to be bunked in people's houses. They can't just, you know, go in and garrison themselves in there. And, you know, they can't be cops, as because it was, right? That's kind of what sparked the Revolutionary War, was when those soldiers shot that black man in Boston.
Crispus and Cox. Yes.
Exactly. And that pissed people off. And, you know, so in a way, you don't want that. What happened at Kent State? You know, and I know that the National Guard is, especially then, was technically a state thing, but look what happened. You know, that's what happens, man, when you give people, you know, 18-year-olds a gun and you tell them, no, these are enemies of the state, you know, and then, you know, there might be terrorists in there. And,
well,
and
okay, so we've got a rational understanding of Posse Comitatus, which comes around at the end of the 19th century as a result of the abuses that happened during Reconstruction in the South. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I, we have just established a rational understanding of Posse Comitatus. Can't use law enforcement, can't use the military as law enforcement against the American people.
Right.
That's kind of what it says. Well, people like John Yoo, however, looked at that at Posse Comitatus. You want to know what they saw? I mean, this is what happens when you do meth and law at the same time or something. I don't know. But they saw Posse Comitatus, and John Yoo argued that because the military would be engaged in fighting terrorism,
yep,
and that they were carrying out raids on terrorist cells and seizing property and so forth,
it was a war on terrorism.
Right. Well, they said that Posse Comitatus would pose no obstacle. This is the language from the New York Times. Would pose no obstacle to the use of troops in a domestic fight against terrorism suspects. Mm-hmm. And this was their reasoning. Because the troops are being used as national security, they aren't police. And therefore, therefore, Posse, dig this. I mean, this is really, really important.
Yeah.
Posse Comitatus doesn't even apply. You know, this is from the same mind that gave us, if it doesn't cause significant organ failure or death, it ain't torture.
Well, Anita's crushing the testicles of a 6-year-old child.
Right.
The president finds a need to do so. I mean, he's a sick, sick puppy. I mean, he's a sick, sick bastard. And to sit there and to let that slide, I mean, he makes all these other guys, you know, that these villains throughout history and our recent history, he makes them look like jokes. I mean, like Nixon would have never done the things that Bush has done and that you enabled Bush to do. And, you know, and to sit there and try to say that, you know, Bush has his name attached to this, doesn't he? I mean, this is his legal counsel. He has, you know, and he enacted these policies. He sat there and signed up statements regarding the fact and executive orders and all these other things. So, yeah, granted, you know, he didn't declare martial law, he didn't suspend elections, he didn't wind up doing a few of these things. I mean, there were certainly...
But they were thinking about it.
Oh, they were planning it, and the whole thing is, well, what is a conspiracy? You know, you don't have to bank in order to be, you know, but if you're caught with blueprints and, you know, security codes and there's a group of you in there and you got weapons and shaped charges, your ass is going to probably jail for, you know,
and, yeah, and this is the other important thing. Eric Holder, the attorney general, gave a speech, and I still have concerns about him and his ties to Chiquita Banana and what went on in Colombia. You know, no passes.
No, but he points for the med raids, but that's another
thing. Right, but he said shortly before the memos were released, the day before yesterday, he said, too often over the past decade, the fight against terrorism has been viewed as a zero-sum battle with our civil liberties. Not only is that thought misguided, I fear that in actuality it does more harm than good. And then, and there's meaning behind this, he said that the memos were being released in light of a substantial public interest in the issue.
Yeah.
In other words, in other words, he said, I'm giving them to you. Now, you make us prosecute these bastards.
Yeah. Exactly.
Here it is. Here's the evidence. Analyze the evidence. Now, get in the streets. March. Tell us to prosecute these people. Give us the popular support that we need to go into the Bolt Hall School of Law and drag that hateful, fascist, tyrannical little bastard out by his heels in chains and go and put him on trial.
Oh, praise the Lord on that one. Praise the Lord.
And that's the nature of my initial inquiry, Albert.
Yep.
What is the level of responsibility? Now that we've got this stuff in our hands, what level of responsibility attaches to the American people?
Mm-hmm.
Not yelling at you, you understand.
I totally get you.
I was out in some freezing damn cold Monday. And you know what? My fingertips are still a little bit funky from the cold.
I hate that.
But I had no choice. Ferg had done something with my gloves that I didn't find out until I couldn't find them. And I had a microphone in my hand and my little gizmo box, so they were exposed flesh. And I was out in that for several hours. And you know what? I'd be more than happy to stand in freezing cold or blazing heat. I'd be more than happy to stand with millions, Albert. To demand the prosecution of the Bradburys and the Bibbies and the John Hughes and David Addington and George Bush and Dick Cheney. Date and time, and I'll find a way to be there. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, it's very important. I mean, it's also, in a sense, on the same breath, it's important for, you know, yeah, we're going to have to push them, and that's without a doubt. However, they're still going to have to do it, or they're going to become just as popular as Bush is. You know, they're not going to be able to, I mean, there's going to have to be a pretty damn big lollipop out there for us to be distracted that much. I mean, you really got to think that there's no way they're just going to be able to get away with little things. This is why I think that, you know, we're starting to hear about these investigations that, you know, kind of have been going on, and they're going to put up their recommendations, and I think that's why you're kind of hearing Nancy Pelosi change her tune a little bit, and yeah, we'll probably see some, you know, some CYA, you know, here and there, but I think we're going to see some justice. I think we're going to see some more, you know, he wants to, you know, I mean, you know, that's the thing. Obama talked about hope, and he'll talk about, you know, transparency. Well, if you think about that, transparency is a huge step forward. I mean, I remember talking to you when I first
So is Pat Leahy calling for a truth commission, although that doesn't contain an element of prosecution. I want prosecution. I want John Yoo to play Parcheesi with the Unabomber for the rest of his days.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to see. We'll have to see if Mr. I Can't Get a Job Gonzalez is going to, you know, do the conservative thing and cover his butt and, you know, we'll see what he does with Bush. And, you know, he said he was going to cooperate. Didn't he say something along those lines? I mean, maybe I was dreaming, but, you know, I'm pretty sure I heard that Gonzalez said he would cooperate, you know, for a deal, naturally. But, I mean, he's another one. And you know, we got to also, who else do we got to get? We got to go get Mr. Let the Eagles Soar. We got to go get him. He's another one.
Ashcroft, yeah.
Ashcroft, yeah, yes. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. And I think, you know, I think it's kind of important that, you know, I don't think we're going to lose track of this kind of stuff. I think that, in a way, maybe with these issues and dealing with the severity of them and, you know, actually getting this stuff handled will be our new celebrity culturally, you know, religion for a while. I think it's going to be the salve that's going to, you know, soothe us when in this painful year. 2009 is going to be pretty rough. 2010 could be worse, you know, and, you know, I think people are just starting to barely feel it now. And I don't say barely, some people are severely feeling, you know, the situation that we're in. And, you know, I don't see anything that the Republicans have said or done to, you know, all I hear them doing is, you can't take these billionaires' money, you can't do this, you can't do that, and they just want to protect the guys who write their paychecks. It's so obvious. It's just, I mean, it's, you know, this transparency is, I think you can also see who's lying to you and who's telling you the truth. I think it's, that's why people are talking about Rush Limbaugh. That's why we're talking about you. I mean, you saw this. I remember we're talking to you about what you said.
This gets a little confusing, doesn't it?
It does, though.
Talking to you about you. Yeah, every penny of it.
It's Seussian. But, I remember talking to that, and, you know, we have known, and now more people are going to know, And once they all know what we know, you know, and once they realize...
Once they know we know, they know we know?
Exactly. And, I mean, you know, you gotta take, you know, there's something about knowing that makes you feel like you have to do something. And if you didn't know, and now you know you got to do something. And one of the things you got to do is talk about it with other people. And by talking about it, it's going to make more and more people know. And the more people know, the more people know. And now we're all going to know about you. We're all going to know about Bush. We're all going to know about all these other creeps and criminals. And we're going to want to do something about it because we're going to see directly where it's impacted our lives to such an extent. I mean, you know, yeah, I understand how Americans, you know, don't understand what that, you know, and they hear, you know, some people get offended. You know, I don't care what the rest of the world thinks about America. This is America. They can kiss my ass, blah, 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 you know. I think they don't understand that because they don't realize, you're not supposed to be in a fancy restaurant where you fly down. You know, like, they don't understand enough to be embarrassed. And I think that they're starting to really kind of start to understand that, man, wow, that is that what that feeling is? It's embarrassing. It's shame. To be humiliated like this on the world stage and to now to start to see it and, you know, and, wow, man, you're going to see. You see. Let spring come. The snow is starting to thaw. It's symbolic to, I'm telling you.
My fingers are starting to thaw.
Yeah, fingers are starting to thaw. People are starting to open their eyes. They're looking around, you know, and it's, you know, this is a big mess. And we've been calling it, and they talk, liberals wanted Bush to fail.
Wow. Yeah, that's one of those that ran through me like a dose of salts, Albert. You know, I didn't have to want Bush to fail.
No.
I knew the man's history, okay? I knew, from the potty training at gunpoint by that hateful old beast to them going and playing golf the day that they planted his baby sister, Robin. It went on and up to, you know, the frogs with the M80s and throwing baseballs and tennis rackets at his friends to the whole academic thing and the Texas Air National Guard. Harkin Energy, Arbustos, Spectrum 7, the Texas Rangers, all of that. I didn't have to want him to fail. I didn't want him to fail. I don't think I've ever wanted a president to fail. Because...
Let me just say...
When Republicans fail, Albert, you know, when Republicans fail, the rich don't take it on the chin. You and me do.
Oh, true, but I think that Bush did fail.
Well, he did. That's the point. I didn't have to want him to. I knew he was gonna.
Well, true. I'm just trying to say in my own way that, yeah, I wanted him to fail because I knew a lot of the things that he was doing was very wrong. Like this John Yoo memos and torture and all this other, and starting wars of aggression and lying about weapons of mass destruction. You bet. Now, did I want, you know, what do you mean fail? Well, how are we going to describe failure? Failure is everybody seeing how wrong he was. And in this country not having a Bush doctrine to speak of ever again, to never allow the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and to not arrest people for wearing a T-shirt You know, like all the things that I mean, and then some that have gone down in the past 8 years. All those things that he did and he stood for, you bet I wanted him to fail. Because I got to say I did, because it was wrong. It was wrong in every way that it's apparent now. I mean, it was one of those things. Now, did I want him to collapse Social Security? Did I want him to do all these things that would, you know, like lessen restrictions on banks and lessen restrictions on the amount of companies and different establishments a media, you know, conglomerate can own in a city? No, that kind of stuff. Those are things you as a president, you want them to uphold your rights and this and that. You don't want him to destroy the economy, but you could see where he was going to. I mean, to sit there and put $2 trillion, though, twice the cost of World War II is what Iraq is going to cost, twice. Once you hear that, you realize that it's not going to be a sustainable thing. And it's not that you want him to fail. It's just, you know, it's going to fail. Bingo. Something driving a truck into a wall. You know, I mean, I can't believe the audacity these people have. You know, look at the wreck that we just had, and they're over here talking about how it's not their fault. I mean, who the hell's been in charge? I mean, you guys have been in charge. Oh, the Democrat Congress. Well, you know how slow the Congress is, number one. But number two, there was Bushies and Republicans oh my God, they've been in charge for the last 20 years. And a lot of this stuff has momentum to it that we don't feel it till later. And so, you know, I hope I don't want Obama to fail in the respect of, do I want him to fail upholding these just miserable things that presidents have been tied into? Yeah, there are things that I think I want Obama to fail on, you bet. I don't think it's a detriment to being a patriot, okay? But to sit there and say I want the president to fail the way the Obama hater Rush Limbaugh says it, you know, I mean, it's a entirely different thing. Because he wants them to fail and government to go bankrupt so him and his buddies can continue their, you know, feeding frenzies, which is what they'd have. They're the ones with all the gold, remember? That's why they're all them commercials for them guys, huh? I wonder how many of these get off in, what's that other dude? Stafford or Stanford. I wonder how many of these Republicans are licking their wounds from these two.
That's one of those things that's going to take a while to come out.
But out
it will, and everyone, all of these things are going to come home to roost at the doorstep of greed.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, are we the only ones that ever heard that? If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Brother. Hey, Albert, I'm going to roll along, brother, but awful good to talk to you, my friend. I thought about you and thought about a lot of other people as we were walking around D.C., and walk around D.C. we did. We're still working on some of the technical angles, but we'll get them all licked. You know, if anybody can do it, we can. And we got it partially licked, but we're still working on stuff. But it was a pleasure talking with you this evening, and please know, and everybody else know, that anytime we go anywhere, you know, Agnes and me are sitting there looking, hey, you know, wonder what Albert thing, look at that, you know, he sure do. And we do. That's the cool, fun part about all of this. So have a great night. Are you beginning to thaw or warm up a little bit? It's March, you know, I don't know what March in Wisconsin's all about.
Yes, sir. I couldn't believe how much snow is missing from my yard. I can see grass and there's a little couple puddles of water, and you know, there's more wildlife out there, not negative. I think it's only, I don't even know where it's at. It's probably like 20 degrees over here right now, but it was sunny enough, the sun's high enough that it's starting to melt and we're starting to thaw out, and I think this is going to be a good spring.
Yeah, well, I think the March the 1st qualified as in like a lion, so hopefully we get out like a lamb. Albert, take care, brother.
All right, brother. Be good.
Bye. All right. Bye now. Calling from Wisconsin, our buddy Albert. And I'm going to take a little break and then come back to the phone. I promise. I promised you some tunage from this album, and it's gorgeous. Go buy this. own this. I bought the download via Amazon, and it was not terribly expensive at all. This is worth your money. Jason Isbell and the 400 unit. In light of what Albert and I were just talking about, this is the perfect bumper. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
Second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
The title of that track, however long,
Again, the album, Jason Isbell, I-S-B-E-L-L, and the 400 unit. That song's got real anthem possibility. However long the dawn will break again. That's where we are now. Trying to break the dawn. That's what exposing the evil of John Yoo and folks like him is about. The cleansing, sanitizing effect of sunlight. And there's 11 tracks on the album. It is a bargain. I can't emphasize enough. Get this. Get this. You will not regret it. And as an independent artist, I have no doubt whatsoever that every sale means something to Jason Isbell and his band, the 400 Unit. Let's go to the phones. Susan is with us from Columbia City, Oregon. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
How are you?
Oh, hanging in there. I do have to disagree with you.
On what level? Or on what topic?
You said earlier that George Bush, you know, his claim to protecting us from attacks was bogus. There were no attacks. You missed one.
Which?
The one where he executed a coup d'etat.
Well, yeah, yeah, no, that right. But they weren't counting those either, so yeah.
Yeah, let's face it. He turned his country into a dictatorship and nobody even noticed.
Well, I don't think that's fair now, is it, Susan? We noticed. A lot of people noticed. It was the do something about it part that was kind of tough. You know.
That's why.
Impeachment's off the table, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I am so pleased to hear Pelosi say she's not really in agreement with the commission for the specific reason because you don't get to prosecute. She was a prosecutor. I can go with that.
Yeah, I can. It would have been nice to have stopped it and you know what? Now we've got the ammunition. Now the next time some right winger says, because I heard it, God, I heard it. Oh, I heard it so many times. Well, where's all these abuses y'all said were going to happen? Where are they? Come on. He hadn't done nothing. He's just the president.
Right.
Well, now we've got the documentary evidence that they were sitting around yearning, sweating, aching for something to happen so that they could grind the American people and our constitutional form of government beneath their nasty hobnailed boots.
For those, I have a tin foil hat moment for you. Has it occurred to you that the reason why the economy was allowed to, who knows, maybe it was given a few discreet shoves, was strictly to force people to the point of desperation. And desperate people will do desperate things, like rebel. You got a rebellion? Martial law.
Yeah, and I hope the significance of that argument was not lost. They didn't argue that it was okay to do it within the framework of posse comitatus. They said it didn't apply. You know, just like the stream buffer zone rule didn't apply to mountaintop removal toxins. Didn't apply.
Two things that bothered me about the way they did the posse comitatus. First of all, I think they had a fallback position. Think Blackwater.
Sure. Well, you know, those camps and all the barbed wire fences that were documented.
Yeah, because a lot of those mercenaries that they were using in Iraq were from outside of the country. They were former death squad members, so on and so forth. They would have no compunction about firing on the citizens of the United States. Not the least. Wouldn't bother them the least.
Hmm. See?
Yeah.
And here's something that really bothers me, and I have not seen, I haven't even seen Rachel Maddow say anything, and it just bugs me to death. She gets Jonathan Turley on and say, and even Jonathan doesn't say anything about it. She gets Jonathan Turley and says, okay, what do we do to get rid of this, to make sure it can't happen? Okay, I'm sitting there yelling the obvious answer. They go right on by. My obvious answer? Repeal the Military Commissions Act!
It would seem obvious, wouldn't it?
Nobody says a word. Duh!
Yeah, it's another one of those cricket moments.
Yeah, and I'm going, And, you know, finally, Bobby's getting to the point where he gets really mad. When I start screaming, stop that. Because it's always the same thing. They just, it's like that law just kind of skated right on past.
And
did they even read it?
It's that's an open question.
Okay, I read it. Which was a pain in the arse right there.
Oh, and by the way, this just hitting. John Yoo, whom we've been talking about,
yeah,
was asked in an interview with the Orange County Register. Now, you know, Orange County, California, you know, bastion of
conservative.
Yeah. They interviewed John Yoo, and the question was put to him: is there anything you would have done differently? What's his first answer?
No.
These memos I wrote were not for public consumption. They lack a certain... Wait. Yeah, somebody bring around the hummingbird tongue canapes, please.
Yes.
They lack a certain polish, I think. Would have been better to explain government policy rather than try to give unvarnished straight talk legal advice. I certainly would have done that differently, but I don't think I would have made the basic decisions differently. This hateful, vile creature still thinks that the Constitution of the United States, for which your and my and so many listeners to the horn and so many Americans' forebears have fought and bled and died, he thinks it's rubbish, Susan. Why is this man not in irons?
Yeah. I'm glad my father's dead. I really am. He can't see this.
They asked him about inquiries at the Justice Department into the legality of his work, and he said, I wish they weren't doing it, but I understand why they are. I hope you understand, John Yoo. I hope John Yoo understands that the reason they are is that there are people in the United States and in the Justice Department who think that he should be wearing an orange jumpsuit for the rest of his natural born life.
Yes, and being the love slave of a big dude named Bubba.
No, I was thinking more Unabomber.
Well,
I want him in that maximum security. 2 hours of sunlight a day, you know, solitary supermax kind of lockdown. Because I don't want anybody to ever get the notion that you can argue that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply, that you can argue that Posse Comitatus simply doesn't apply, that you can argue that the First Amendment can be subjugated to the whim of an ignorant president. I don't want everybody, you know, I don't want anybody ever again, Susan, to think that they can get away with making that argument.
Well, I would much prefer to see the whole crew of them, rather than being prosecuted here, I would much prefer to see the whole, see the investigation here and handed over all of the evidence and the people handed over to The Hague. You know why?
Why is that?
Because the very first Republican president that gets into office is going to pardon them if they're tried and imprisoned here. If they're sitting on their butts in The Hague, there is no pardon.
Well, I just looked up because this is what I would like to see him prosecuted under. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies. This is Article 3, Section 3 of the United States Constitution, which John Yoo despises. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Well, when you try to dismantle our constitutional form of government, and in light of what our so-called enemies said, how is that not giving them aid and comfort, Susan?
That would be a stretch.
No, that's not a stretch at all. It materially aided and comforted Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. When John Yoo sought to materially alter the constitutional form of government of this nation in response to their goading or attacks.
I have to give you that, because what they did was the best recruiting tool that Al-Qaeda ever had. So in a way, I guess you could consider that aid and abetting and aid and comfort.
Consider that Congress shall have the power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. There's some stuff that comes to play here. This interview with the Orange County reporter, register, whatever, what have you.
Yeah, he just opened his yap and hung himself.
That certainly looks like a confession to me.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have made the basic decisions differently.
And if you're going to put him up for treason, you have to put up George and Dick.
Well, that's the thing. You put Addington and Bibby and that dirty crowd up on charges of treason, and you go to them and say, well, fellas, you know what the punishment for treason is, right?
Yep.
Now, we can go forward, and you will be convicted, and you will be punished accordingly, unless you go work on your scales and come back and sing like a bird on the people who told you to come up with these decisions. Because we know what the decision-making process was in the Bush White House, Susan. Remember Richard Clark?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how after September the 11th, 2001, he was called to the White House by Bush and told to find a link between September 11th and Saddam Hussein? Not to find out who done it, but to find a link to Saddam Hussein. He came back and said there is no link, and Bush said go back and look again. The Downing Street memo, the facts were being fitted to the situation. What was that language? I've almost forgotten it now.
Cherry picking.
Well, but yeah, that's the term for it. These are concepts of treason.
Uh-huh. Oh, and that other thing that Bin Laden wanted us to do, by the way, was to get out of
Saudi Arabia.
No, it was Bin Sultan Air Base.
Which was in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but I mean, give the base back to the Saudi government, which we did immediately.
Well, George was a coward. At heart, George is a coward, and he did what he was told.
Yeah, as soon as he did what he was told, no problem.
Yeah. Hey, Susan, I got to run on here, but the good points and good ideas, and good to talk to you. I'm glad to be back.
One other, real fast.
Sure.
Religious things. They have now come up with a heavenly blessed debt.
Debt?
You die. Now they're going after your relatives, even if you have no estate.
Boy, send me that link, would you?
Should be.
Yeah, send me that link. Take care, Susan. Bye now.
Okay, I will. Bye-bye.
Luke is with us from East Tennessee. Oh, we lost Luke. His battery was dying. Doggone it. Hate that for him. Well, let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, Bob.
Hey, Ed, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I thought I would chime in with a couple items that I see. They're probably not as complicated as I've been here and there, but I just wanted to comment on jobs in the auto industry and this bailout. They made 15 million too many cars last year. They're not selling. They're sitting on the lots. So my question is, why in the tarnation are we bailing out companies that are making stuff at our expense and that it's not selling? Can you explain our way out of that one?
Well, I think those are two different topics, Ed. One is related to management and management-based decisions. You know, the working people, the people who are feeding families and putting kids through school and buying clothing and keeping the economy going to the extent that it's going, their job was not to ask people or ask management, are you sure we need this many cars? They were there and happy to be going to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping their own little communities alive in the process. So, and then as the question as to why we're bailing them out, I don't like that phrase "too big to fail." I don't like that phrase "too big to fail."
Oh, okay.
But the fact of the matter is, in the state that the economy is in now, if we let GM and Chrysler sink beneath the waves, they'll take Ford with them, and they'll take the Japanese car makers who are in the United States as well. They'll take BMW and Mercedes who are in the United States too. While that good for nothing POS Richard Shelby down in Alabama was clucking and gleefully celebrating Detroit's problems and talk about what is working for us down here with our Mercedes plant. That dummy didn't realize that Detroit going down will take the rest of the world's automakers with it.
Yeah.
So that's the short answer of why you can't just let it die.
Well, if you notice in all the other depressions, and it's like a girl when I was instructing classes, she said, I don't mind paying $18 for a sweater, but said I'd like to make enough to buy it. So that's the same theory of flooding the market with products or whatever, that merchandise that is not going to be used.
Yeah, and of course, you know, if people have the money to do it, there's never been a better time to buy a car than right now.
Oh, I agree. In fact, we were looking, but that really don't get to the bottom of, I guess, the way I think, or, you know, what's the use of planting more apple trees if apples ain't selling?
No, I understand that, but by the same token, the fact that Detroit is said to have produced 15,000 too many cars, was it 15,000 too many cars when the economy wasn't soured? So, you know, it's a question, Ed, of whether or not it's 15,000 too many cars if people don't have the money to buy cars.
Not 15,000, 15 million.
I'm sorry, 15 million. My bad. It's 15 million too many if people don't have the money to buy them. And it also plays into questions of our so-called consumer culture. Now, Ed, I'm guessing, I'm pretty sure I'm right. You were raised in a time when you didn't waste anything.
That's exactly right.
Well, we, in the consumer culture that was deliberately foisted upon the people of the United States starting in the early 1950s, we created this notion that, you know, you were somehow socially tainted if you didn't have a new car every 5 years.
Well, that didn't bother how they tainted me. I'll manage my money, and I'm not. They can go out and buy. Well, you know, that's the craziest damn thing. That's the craziest thing I ever heard of at a time like this. Go out and spend your money? That's got to be the bottom of the bucket talking. I'd say you better hold on to some to...
Well, if you've got any left, I mean, if for people who were playing in the stock market, whether they wanted to or were compelled to via their retirement systems, how do you hang on to what's left when it just keeps trying to dribble away?
Well, we caught ours before the big stuff hit. We still lost some, but not people's losing now. But I still don't agree with paying people for failure, and I fully realize, being a union man and being an ex-member of the United Auto Workers, I understand what you're saying, but how long do we spend before there is no more spending to be done?
There is a way around this, but it's going to take spending.
It's going to take what?
It's going to take spending. It's going to take wise spending. It seems to me it would be much more economic to buy General Motors and buy Chrysler at their par value, and then retool the auto industry from the inside out, and let the American people own those things until they can become financially viable, and let those companies buy their way back into privacy.
Well,
as opposed to just pumping money into them, because
you don't hear those kind of ideas, though. That's too innovative for.
No, you don't hear those ideas, Ed, because the right wing screams that's socialism.
Yeah, you know something? The first person that says socialism in my face, I'm gonna socialize him, and I mean it. That is so disgusting. When all of the CEOs and all of them now are going that way, you know, that socialism's all right. It's for them. It's like Congress and the Senate. National health bill is real good for them, but that ain't so good for us. That's socialism if it comes up. I don't give a dang what kind of name they tag it with. And they can call me anything they want to as long as I get me a check at the end of the week. That's the way I felt when I was working. And I think most people that's got any common sense use that approach. You know, yeah, maybe a little bit pink, maybe a little bit, off base, but I'm gonna stick with that theory that, you bring home the paycheck when you got a family to feed. So, but I to change. Do you have a
no? Go right ahead.
Do you have any response to that?
No, go right ahead, Ed. It seems to me that working families deserve every bit as much regard as well-heeled Wall Street bankers.
Yeah,
and you know we didn't sweat a whole lot bailing them out.
Yeah, well, I saw a thing years ago in a book, a little booklet, using 9, 10, 11 pages. Secretary hanging, I think I told you this, hanging on the doorway, hollering at the senator, said, "Hurry up and go over to Naval Hospital to get your free examination and medicine." So you can come back and vote against the national health bill.
Yeah.
So that's, and you know what? That's been 40 years ago. I haven't forgot it then. If I live to be another 40 years old, I won't forget it. Because that really irks me that how even elected people that come out of the same mold as a lot of us come out of, some of them did, that they can get so high above where they come from. But I'll drop that, and I would like to give you an opinion, get an explanation on where I'm probably off base on this. They holler jobs, jobs, jobs. That's the biggest crock creating jobs. That's still making jobs. The key to the daggone job situation is put so much high tariffs and taxes on these goods that's coming in. If we're even tooled to do those jobs anymore, is make them bring them back. That is, Bob, that's the simplest.
You do know we tried that, right, Ed?
No, I didn't.
It was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. And we did that smack dab in the beginning of the Great Depression, and it crushed us.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. I know most acts like the Smith Act and all that, but I didn't realize that that had been tried. And so who crushed that? The politicians or the...
No, it started a worldwide trade war.
I don't give a dang if it did. That started any kind of war. I'd say...
No, it meant that our goods couldn't sell. Well, among other things, it crippled the credit markets again. When Wall Street and the banks were still reeling, we put tariffs on everything coming into the U.S., so everything that the U.S. was shipping out got tariffs hammered onto it, and they wouldn't sell.
Well, at least we're playing on even ground. Not really,
Ed, because it's not even ground, because we start out with a tariff, and the other side, and some other country puts a tariff on our goods that's higher than our tariff on theirs. So we raise ours, so somebody else raises theirs. And the next thing you know, it's just a tariff war.
Do you mean to tell me, though, that we do not have the intelligence and the industry qualifications and the people qualifications to run this country internally almost efficiently without outside input?
Well, it's a more complex question than what you're asking. The first answer is no, we don't have that anymore. I said if it was done. Yeah, but look, Ed, consider the Great Depression and the onset of World War II. We had factories that could make stuff, but they were idled for financial reasons. When it was time to crank it up to fight the Second World War, we had a workforce and we had an industrial manufacturing base, and so we could make what we needed during the Second World War. Interestingly enough, financed by the United States government. You know, the private sector didn't fight the Second World War, but that's a separate topic. But we'll have that now. And the time that it would take to build that back up is time that we don't have. We would just continue to get worse. Now, the second part of your question, my second answer to your question, lies in the fact that it may be us doing stuff, making stuff and so forth. But, Ed, the money, for as rich as this country has been, a great deal of the finance has always been outside of this country, whether it was the English or the Dutch or the Japanese, and now it's the Chinese. You know, this is all rather complicated. If we crush, for instance, the Chinese economy, they hold our debt and they call our note, and that crushes us, because George Bush spent 8 years when it wasn't necessary, hanging bad paper all over the Asian mainland in order to finance, you know, not a rebuilding program for American economies, not shoring up the middle class. George Bush hung bad paper all over Asia in order to finance a war that we didn't, two wars that we didn't need to be in, and to prop up tax cuts for his pals. We had 8 years writing hot checks.
Yeah, but that still don't, that still isn't necessarily what's killed our economy. The, it's funny that all the other nations has fallen with us. If we fail, everybody fails. Well, it's beyond my understanding how that this can go on. Looks like our progress or our success would depend on what we do and not on what China. And I know what you're saying about them holding the notes and they got a hammer over their head. I would be the first to agree with that. But as long as people still undermine, and I've talked to people that when they mention Walmart, I think, well, you're another one of them that undermines this country. And until we get some of those jobs back over here, probably jobs that they've exported in the last 2 years would put the people back to work. Good paying jobs. But they're in India or wherever.
Whether they're good paying is open to discussion. I mean, the reason, for instance, that telemarketing jobs went to South Asia and Southeast Asia and points elsewhere, the reason those jobs went there is because there was a virtual slave labor workforce that would work for pennies on the dollar. Consider that someone doing technical support in a U.S. call center, okay, for some computer or some such. You know, in other words, you know, it's inbound telephone work. That person might have been making it $12 an hour. Now, under no set of circumstances is that a living wage in the United States. So
no,
those people,
that's $20,000 a year, and it beats what they're making now.
And from a labor standpoint, that's exact, you know, and let things continue, and that's the, and that's how corporate America will think, because that's the point. You take the American jobs away to somewhere else, and you pay, you know, if they were making $12 an hour in the United States, somebody working this in India is maybe making $3. Okay? So that's $9 net profit to the corporate bosses. But what happens is when all the jobs are gone from America, American wages stagnate and start to deflate and go down. And once American workers are desperate enough, we bring them back and we tell them, well, here's a job for $9 an hour. You ought to be happy to have it. You know, we've got a governor in this state.
Where they're heading, you know, China's not going to come up with their wages or these other countries. They expect us to go back to meet them.
Right, and that's what...
I don't know what the picture is, but it's still... you know what? It seems like you've got the counter answers to my questions or my statements, but I certainly don't agree with all this stimulus stuff at all. Now, I do agree that helping the people with direct checks will give them some relief for a while, and the tax break that they're giving the middle class, it will help them. But it's nothing. The answer is, give me a job.
And you know what?
Something
we
can depend on.
We can do that. I just spent a week listening to the reality of that. The fact of the matter is, there is one way, to bring good-paying jobs to the United States of America that aren't somewhere else. And that is in what is called the greening of the economy, Ed. That's wind and solar and geothermal.
I'm 110% on top of that.
Just think about it for a minute. What happens when GM shuts down a production plant? Say, you know, somewhere making Hummers, and they shut down Hummer. What happens to those workers? They're just out on the street, right?
They're out on the street or have to hunt some scabby job that is just barely keeping body and soul together.
And General Motors isn't standing there saying, "Well, we want to help you transition to a new way of earning a living."
Well, I guess the only answer I've got to that
is
I've got a little bit of land out here. I let them park their excess automobiles out here.
Well, just wait a minute. What happens, and you know, you and me, we live in a neck of the woods where you don't have to drive very far to see this. What happens when the coal plays out in a mine? What happens to that coal company town?
It's a ghost town.
Yeah, when the coal company packs up and leaves and takes the money it's made and goes away, the people don't matter. It's a ghost town.
That's right.
Now, in both of the examples that I've cited to you, Ed, there's only one answer, and that is to prepare people for a sustainable economy. Because for the foreseeable next couple of billion years, the sun is still going to be in the sky. And as long as the sun's in the sky and the earth is turning on its axis, there are going to be winds. And it is still mighty hot as you go down into the bowels of the earth. And that's all part of a complex relationship. And in the course of transitioning to an economy where our energy is based on wind and solar and geothermal, well, it's like the Coal River Wind Project, Ed. It'll take 14 or 15 years to take down Coal River Mountain. And after that, Massey will pack up bag and baggage, they'll take down all their facilities, and they'll go and destroy something else, if there's anything else left to destroy.
Oh, I know what the filthy bastards are.
The community dies, the community's poisoned, and Massey's not standing there saying, "Well, you know, we'll find another way for you to make a living." They say, "So long, suckers."
Yep.
Okay? Now, on the other hand, the Coal River Wind Project that would put windmills on top of those mountains, industrial wind, well, it's going to take 200 to 400 men and women working to build those things, and that's a two to four year job. After that, it's going to take a workforce of in excess of 50 people, permanent jobs, union jobs, with good wages and benefits and a pension and health care. It's going to take in excess of 50 people to maintain that wind farm. Now, those 50 people are going to go shopping, and those 50 people are going to need work clothes, and those 50 people are going to need work boots, and those 50 people are going to buy cars, and those 50 people are going to stop at little mom-and-pop grocery stores and get their bologna sliced for their sandwiches. All right?
If there's any mom-and-pops left.
This is the only way that there are. On the one hand, you've got very short-term the self-consumptive mountain removal coal extraction that has a finite, definable end. And on the other hand, you've got a green economy that has no end in sight, where there will always be jobs. Think about it, Ed. Think about people who want to do wind and solar at their homes and have solar panels and wind turbines of their own. Because, you know, we live in West Virginia. It's kind of windy around here.
Mm-hmm.
My wife says it's terrible windy right here where we live. I don't think she'd talk about the weather. But anyway, somebody's got, you know, mom, the people who own those things are not necessarily going to know how to maintain them. So an entire industry has to rise up around that to teach people how to maintain solar systems that heat water for solar steam heat in the winter, that teach people how to maintain wind turbines so that they can keep the electricity going to people's homes. This is the future. And the plants that manufacture the solar panel and the incredibly amazing complex films that coat those things that grab the rays of the sun more efficiently and bring them in. And we've got to have plants that build the lithium-ion batteries.